The Committee of Job Growth and Energy Affordability will come to order. What we're going to do today, ladies and gentlemen, is as soon as we get a quorum, we're going to approve the minutes. Just a little plan for how the day is going to work. Number one, we are not going to be voting on anything today. We're going to be hearing public testimony to get through the substance of this bill. The House does go into session today at 11 a.m. This committee will recess at about 10-2 so that the members can get upstairs and be in session. We will then reconvene after session is done. I will make an announcement on the floor to let folks know. I'm guessing session will probably be 15, maybe 20 minutes or so. It shouldn't be a real long session, so that's the plan. We'll reconvene after session. Also, members and folks from the audience here, the deadline for amendments to this bill is 3 o'clock today, just for your information. What we're going to do, I'm going to call forth some testifiers here. We've got a lot of folks that want to speak. Some of them have driven quite a distance. So what the plan is we're going to try to limit member questions unless it's absolutely critical. Try to let the testifiers get through their information. Testifiers, if we could keep it, I would like you to have your goal be about 3 minutes tops, if you can. If you look at the list, it's not going to take long for us to go many hours into testimony if we don't. And with that, we'll bring Dan Dorman down here up first. Melissa Ron, you're on deck, and John Duklik, you are after Melissa. And with that, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Dan Dorman. I'm the Executive Director of the Greater Minnesota Partnership. We represent about 90 different members throughout Greater Minnesota and work exclusively on economic development issues. I wanted to talk a little bit about a couple of things in the bill that we're very happy to see there, starting with the BDPI or the Greater Minnesota.
Excuse me, Business. Mr. Dorman, you need to pull that microphone a little closer to you.
Okay, how's that, Mr. Chair?
One more time.
One, two, three, four, five.
It's better. Yeah.
A little closer. All right, here I can go.
We heard that.
There you go. Okay, I'll lean in close. The BDPI or Business Development Public Infrastructure Program is funded in the bill at $1.3 million through 2021. This is the cash portion of a program that is also carried in the bonding bill that provides needed infrastructure. There is an appropriate carve-out in the bill for a project in with Thief River Falls that makes sense, and so we're really happy to see that included. The workforce housing section of the bill, particularly the grant program, we're very excited to see that after working on this issue for several years. And I think the best thing to say about it is for a lot of communities in Greater Minnesota, continuing to do what we've done for 10 or 15 or 20 years with some slight variations really hasn't made a big difference. So we're really excited to see what we think is a new approach to this, more of a market-based approach to trying to solve the workforce housing crisis in Greater Minnesota, which is holding back our economic development. The changes in the job training program, there's a job incentive program in the bill that is funded at $900,000 a year for 18 and 19 and bumps up to $1.36 million. This is a relatively new program, but if you have an opportunity, if you haven't seen it, take a look at where the grants are going. Most of them are going to small and mid-sized manufacturers in Greater Minnesota that hopefully will grow and become much larger. So that program is really working very well, Mr. Chair. Those are the areas that we're really happy to see. We think it's a step in the right direction. And with that, I'll cease my comments unless you have any questions.
Well, thank you for your testimony.
Thank you, Mr.
Next
Chair.
Up is Melissa Ron. Melissa, are you here? All right, not seeing Melissa. We'll put her on hold. How about John?
We're here.
Oh, I see. Thank you. Please state your name for the record.
Michael Zabel, President and CEO of True Shrimp Company in Ballaton, Minnesota, a affiliate of Ralco Nutrition Incorporated out of Marshall.
Welcome to the committee. Please proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm here representing an opportunity. I believe it's in your bill, it's page 64, section 3, shrimp production incentive. This incentive is designed to assist in the building of a shrimp aquaculture industry here in Minnesota. The company that I represent has developed a technology to be able to grow shrimp indoors efficiently, safely, and traceable. This industry, once given an opportunity to grow, we had a University of Minnesota Extension do a economic impact study for us. One of our shrimp production facilities is called a harbor, and that harbor is quite large. It covers 9 acres and will grow about 8 million pounds of shrimp a year. The economic contribution, that just the building of that harbor, would be $48 million, affect 330 people employment, and an estimated income of about $14 million. In addition, the Extension Service went on and said, what would be the economic contribution of that harbor ongoing year in and year out? And there they estimated to be about $30 million a year, employing 124 both directly and indirectly with an annual payroll of over $6 million. We are building a complete industry. The company that I work with, we are going to supply the feed, the post larva, which is the small shrimp. We're also going to do the processing, sales, and marketing. Processing today will be done in Marshall, Minnesota. Our feed supplier is New Vision Co-op out of Worthington, Minnesota. We estimate we'll use 15 million pounds of feed annually, and over 45% of that feed is soy and soy derivatives. In the Extension Service study, they thought we could impact the price of a bushel of soybeans by 5 to 15 cents with just one harbor. And the idea, of course, is to build an industry with multiple harbors across the entire state of Minnesota. I'd like to introduce Mr. Jim Sieben, please.
Yeah, Jim Sieben. Jim Sieben, president of Novatech Engineering and president of Minwest Technology Campus out in Wilmer, Minnesota. So 5 years ago when we were looking at our plans to diversify, presently we are in the poultry industry that we make products for. We are a robotics company that takes complex issues and converts them to processes that work for the industry. Today we are in 49 countries. We are bumping $30 million a year. 67% of our revenue comes from outside of the country, and 90% of our revenue comes from outside of the state of Minnesota. When we were evaluating the idea of doing the shrimp processing, we did a full global evaluation of the shrimp markets and what is out there today. There is not a good processing equipment out there at all. And the industry has done much with labor. Much of it is slave labor. And we are looking at putting a product out there that will allow us to expand not only from the true shrimp production facility, but fully international as we are presently doing our hatchery products.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. Members, if you have a critical question, we'll take a quick one here. Representative Mullen.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple things I want to talk about, and then I want to ask a question. You're limiting testimony to 3 minutes, but many of these bills have not been heard at all in committee. So I do want to encourage people, if they have a question about a bill, particularly if it has not been heard in committee, that we should question this. And the three-minute limit is, unless you're just expecting this bill to not have any legs once it hits the governor's office, and then it's just a charade. The other thing is it okay for us, if we have amendments, to get them emailed or email you the outline of the amendment by 3 o'clock? Seems how we're going to be in committee all day or on the floor. How do you want to do that?
Representative Mahoney, I had conferred with Representative Chair Garofalo last night, and then just reconnecting here with staff. We're going to follow the standard procedures. They need to be due by. They need to be in by 3 o'clock. We're going to keep it that way. Also, your comment about limiting testimony for bills that we haven't heard. You make a valid point. We will entertain additional testimony and some questions if we need to. But again, it's just how late you want to be here. We have folks that have driven quite a distance. I understand that there are some questions that you need to have answered. Some questions can be answered offline. If we're able to do that, we will in the essence of time. If it's a question that can't be answered offline or followed up with a letter or an email to committee members, then we'll go ahead and vet that here. But let's try to keep that in mind, okay?
Thank you, Mr. Sharon. Now to my question.
Representative Mahoney.
The shrimp incentive is somewhere in the area of $50 to $60 million. And you've said 124 jobs. That cannot be the total jobs that you're talking about. I would like to have an understanding of how many jobs this bill, this $60 million over however many years I think it's 10 or 11 years, will affect. Because if it's just 127 jobs at a $60 million subsidy, that's about, I thought it was like in the area of, well, I'll give it to you in a minute. Come on. I love this. $483,870,000 per subsidy per job. That is something we as a state can't do. So I need to understand, and I think the committee and the public need to understand what the subsidy of a job is. This is getting into Iron Range areas here. So,
to the testifier.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you, Representative Mahoney, for the question. The 124 jobs is for the harbor and the harbor alone, and each harbor will have 124 direct and indirect. To support that harbor, there has to be a hub or a center of excellence, and inside that hub, there is a genetic facility, there'll be multiple hatcheries, a processing facility, a sales and marketing and distribution organization, plus a laboratory. In Battleton, Minnesota, we built a state-of-the-art shrimp laboratory. That laboratory already employs 17 people, and we estimate that the hub alone will be 120 people employed. And then every harbor that we add, and of course that's the idea behind the incentive, will add additional people not only to the harbor, but also to the hub as the industry grows. And I'd like to, Mr. Seidman, to talk about employment outside the company.
Yeah, if I could add that.
To the testifier.
I'm sorry. If I could add to that, today Novatech Engineering has 160 employees, and we average about $50,000 a year in those employees. Our intentions are to build a business that is similar to what we presently have. So we see ourselves having another 50 to 100 employees over the period of putting this product into the field.
Representative Mahoney, do you have any other questions that can't be followed up offline?
Well, Mr. Chair, even at this number, we're at about $150,000 a year per job over the 10 years, or about $15,000 subsidy per job. And the key here is, what is the return in tax, income tax and taxes to the state, and how long does it take for us to get it? Now, I'm not opposed to this particular enterprise. I think it's, you know, if we're going to add value to ag in greater Minnesota, that's just fine, and I'm happy to do that. But I think taxpayers of Minnesota need to understand what the subsidy of the job is. And if it's at the numbers that were just mentioned here, put this subsidy at about $150,000 per job. So I want people in the state to understand that that's what we do here.
Members, we have a quorum at this time. At this time, seeing that Representative Mahoney was very intent with his study, he's going to move the minutes for our last meeting dated March 23rd. Representative Mahoney moves the minutes. All those in favor of adopting the minutes from our last meeting, please indicate by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed? The motion prevails. The minutes have been adopted. Representative Wagenius, do you have a question that can be followed up offline?
I would like to ask it online if I could.
Online? Okay, let's be brief.
Yes. For each of your harbors...
Please speak into the microphone.
Thank you. For each of your harbors, are they self-contained, or will they be set up to use our wastewater treatment facilities?
To the testifier.
Mr. Chairman, they are self-contained. We have complete wastewater treatment facilities on the premises of the harbor. It is to our value to recycle every drop of water because we have to turn it into salt water. So we have wastewater treatment plant.
Thank you. Thank you for your answer. And then Representative Guinness, I'll give you one more.
So you will have waste, though, and what happens to that waste?
To the testifier.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we will have a solid waste, and quite frankly, it's our intention to turn that into a co-product of the harbor. So we're going to limit the waste as much as we can. The waste of the fecal matter, of the uneaten feed, is still rich with protein and can be used for a terrestrial feed.
Thank you for your testimony. Representative Dabney, you got the final question.
Thank you, Representative Neuberger. Will you be back for further subsidies for additional harbors or locations?
To the testifier.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, no, not at this time. Although I would like to tell you, as we build this, we'd like to keep you informed of how this industry will be progressing as we go through this.
Thank you. Thank you. Sure.
Members, thank you for your testimony. Representative Sundin, let's make this quick, okay?
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The testifier mentioned a $50,000 average wage. You're including all the executives and professional personnel. What's the entry-level wages on a project?
To the testifier.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I believe that was Jim that mentioned, Mr. Sieben mentioned the $50,000. Our starting wage in our models is $15 with full benefits, but we, too, will have a large technical staff centered around the animal husbandry, the biology, and the water chemistry related to the harbor.
Thank you for your testimony. Our next testifier up today will be John Dukic. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, John Dukic with the Minnesota High Tech Association. We are a trade association that represents more than 300 science and technology businesses throughout the state of Minnesota. And I'd just like to, first of all, thank the committee, Mr. Chair, Representative Garofalo, and Representative O'Neill for your work on the SciTech Experience Internship Program. We're pleased to see that that has been fully funded, which will provide up to or actually more than 650 science and technology internships at small companies throughout the state of Minnesota, and I should mention that those are paid internships. We're also pleased to see that the VoIP and small cell provisions are included in the bill, and are pleased to see that funding for broadband and the Office of Broadband is included, and are hopeful to see maybe that funding bumped up a little bit. And with that, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, thank you for your testimony. Up next, we have Andrew Moratska. On deck, we have Commissioner Hardy. And after Commissioner Hardy, we have Commissioner Tingerthal. Andrew Moratska, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Andrew Moratska. I'm a partner at the law firm Stoll Reeves, focused my practice on representing large industrial end users of energy and independent power producers on matters before the Public Utilities Commission. My work over the past decade has spanned many regulatory dockets, including utility rate cases, utility resource plans, and certificate of need proceedings. I'm testifying today on behalf of the Minnesota Large Industrial Group, an ad hoc coalition of large industrial end users of gas and electricity, who, as a group on the electric side, consume in excess of six billion kilowatt hours annually and pay more than $350 million in electric bills. I'm here today to speak very narrowly on Article 10 of the omnibus and specifically Sections 10, 11, 12, 20, 21, and 22. In the past, the legislature has amended state law to require the commission to consider a variety of factors when setting rates or approving utility investments, including low-income customers, energy efficiency, and the environment. The Minnesota Large Industrial Group believes that the legislature can and should require jobs in the economy to also be considered. In very simple terms, the legislation we support does just that. Sections 10, 11, and 12 put economic growth and job retention into the Commission's general rate-setting provisions. Section 20 requires an analysis of the economy, job growth, and job retention into the Commission's review of utility resource plans. And Sections 21 and 22 require the Commission to balance calculations of environmental costs, renewable preference with the economy, job growth, and job retention. Minnesota Large Industrial Group supports these revisions, and I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you for your testimony. Up next, we have Commissioner Hardy. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Shantara Hardy, and I'm the Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Employment and Economic Development, also known as DEED. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on the House Omnibus Bill. I appreciate the challenge of crafting a legislative budget, especially one with a difficult target. As you know, Governor Dayton and Lieutenant Governor Smith proposed an opportunity budget focused on protecting Minnesota's financial future while supporting a strong economy for everyone in our state. Unfortunately, there are many parts of this bill not aligned with that agenda. In the interest of time, and because I've sent the committee a detailed letter, my testimony will highlight the provisions, those that we strongly support, those that drastically decrease funding, and those that include harmful policy that will limit workforce and economic development opportunities throughout Minnesota. Starting with broadband. As you know, from attracting and retaining businesses and talent and improving student success, high-quality broadband is a leveling playing field for driving economic development in communities throughout greater Minnesota. That's why the governor recommended $60 million in fiscal year 18 and 19 to expand access to at least 23,000 households and businesses in greater Minnesota. I am concerned that the $7 million proposed in the House bill will not keep pace with the identified needs and will limit access. In addition, the bill also eliminates funding to our office that is responsible and that is a lean office for staffing the delivery of grants for this program. As you know, with limited funding, this office will have difficulties administering future grants and measuring our progress towards our state goals, and also monitoring the more than $66 million in existing grants that we have. I urge you to fully fund at the governor's level. The other area of concern in economic development is our Minnesota Investment and Job Creation Fund. These are effective tools used to craft incentive packages to meet differing business needs across the state. MIF and Job Creation have invested over $70 million in business expansions and have helped create over 10,000 jobs throughout the state. The House bill falls short of replenishing the cuts from last session, only increasing MIF funding by $1 million in fiscal year 18 and job creation by $1.5 million in fiscal year 18 and 19. I encourage you to fund the programs at the governor's recommended levels at $30 million for MIF and $25 million for JCF for fiscal year 18 and 19. In addition, I urge you to adopt the governor's policy recommendations, which increase flexibility for the agency and provides greater help for businesses in greater Minnesota. Lastly, the bill includes language that would negatively impact the operation of the Job Creation Fund. It restricts where DEED can award resources, really based on unemployment for the past prior months. I want to just note, under this language, which areas throughout the state would be ineligible at this time. You'll see in the letter, in the Twin Cities, Anoka, Carver, Dakota, Hennepin, Ramsey, and Scott, and Washington would no longer receive funds. in Greater Minnesota, Blue Earth, Clay, Dodge, Douglas, Goodhoe, Lincoln, Candy Ohio, Nobles, Nicollet, Olmsted, Pipestone, Pipe, Rice, Rock, Stern, Steel, and Stevens, and a number of regional centers throughout the state will no longer receive these funds. As you know, these are the bread and butter to be able to help businesses come in these communities, especially in our Greater Minnesota communities. The other area I'll call your attention to is our Minnesota Trade Office, which this budget cuts by 23%. This budget also cuts the four global trade offices that we have around the state, around the country, excuse me, around the nation that helps us with our international marketing of the state. For the first time in 13 years, if this language would pass, we would have no foreign offices, which would greatly impact our state's presence in the global market. I strongly urge you to fund the Minnesota Trade Office at the current level. In the workforce area, the bill fails to fund the governor's recommended $7 million to increase funding for our Vocational Rehabilitation Services Program. Without this increase, VRS will be forced to close Category 1, which serves Minnesotans with the most severe disabilities. All new clients, an estimated 5,800 Minnesotans per year, will be placed on an indefinite waiting list until the fall. It's critical as we look at employment rates of over 9% in our communities with disabilities that we fund the $7 million or we will not be able to serve further clients in this program. The other area I'll mention is our equity investments. As you know, Minnesota has some of the largest economic disparities in the country. And if our state intends to prosper economically as it has in the past, we have to close these gaps. I am encouraged that we agree that our Pathways to Prosperity program is our state's top strategy, and you've invested in this program. I thank the committee for that. However, the equity investments that were put into the law last session, the direct appropriation and the competitive grants, are very important to closing those economic disparity gaps. This bill eliminates those appropriations during the time when those organizations haven't had a chance to actually show outcomes, and so I hope that the committee will consider the funding. Lastly, with respect to our operations, the bill caps full-time employee counts by division and program and reduces the number of deputies from 4 to 1. These caps are arbitrary and void of any strategic purpose as they could impact the quality and timeliness of deed services. Under this bill, deed would not be able to respond to any increased demands in the economy, and it's our belief and the governor's belief that the commissioner, myself and those after me, should have the authority to determine the appropriate organizational structure and staffing levels to work the agency in order to meet the needs of Minnesotans. Additionally, the bill contains language that limits transfers between agencies within a department. For example, we have a program with my colleague in the Department of Labor and Industry, which we transfer money as mandated by law. Under this language, the apprenticeship program would not receive funds for deed. These partnerships are very important to leveraging services and the expertise of existing staff, which we believe is cost-effective and more efficient for our clients. This language is unnecessary and hinders the efficiency within state government. Mr. Chair and members, as the work of this session continues, I hope that we can continue to work together to improve this bill and the proposed recommendations in order to carry out the critical services at DEED. That concludes my prepared remarks. I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you for your testimony. Our next testifier is Commissioner Tingerthal. On deck is Commissioner Ken Peterson. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Mary Tingerthal. I am the commissioner at the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency. I want to thank the committee for giving us an opportunity to talk about this bill. I agree with the first speaker, Mr. Dorman, about the importance of workforce housing throughout the state of Minnesota. You already heard testimony about potentially more jobs in western Minnesota. But frankly, I'm baffled by the fact that Mr. Dorman feels that this bill actually increases the resources for workforce housing in greater Minnesota. In fact, what it does is it takes a program already funded at DEED in the base budget and moves it to Minnesota Housing, And then it slashes nearly $13 million from the Minnesota Housing Challenge Fund, which has been used since 1999 to produce workforce housing in greater Minnesota. We have worked together with the Department of Economic Development over the last 4 years using both the Challenge Fund and the Workforce Housing Funds to develop over 1,200 units of workforce housing in greater Minnesota, both homeownership and rental properties. And this would literally shut the program down in fiscal year 19 for any housing that would be supported under the Challenge Fund. And 90% in the last year of dollars that came from the Challenge Fund went to greater Minnesota. So we're not talking about a program that maybe committee members have issues with where those dollars have gone. We are talking about a program that simply will not be available in fiscal year 19 if the bill moves ahead as it is proposed. With regard to the workforce housing program that is proposed in the bill to be moved from Deed to Minnesota Housing, we have supported that program. We have worked with Deed, but we have two issues that we would like to bring up to the committee that if you choose to move forward with this, we think should take your attention. The first is this bill still includes language that prohibits the dollars in this section of the bill from being combined with any dollars, local, state, federal, that require any kind of income limits. We understand that that the workforce housing program is one that the authors wish to not be subject to income limits, but we think it's short-sighted to not allow the combination of funding. Over the last 2 years, as we've worked with Deed, we have literally funded projects across the street from each other in places like Perham and Thief River Falls because of this prohibition. We are not suggesting in any way that it should be a requirement that these funds be combined with other funds, but we think that communities should have the option of combining funds so that you could have a mixed income development if that's what that community feels is best for it. The workforce housing program does require a match of local funds, so it really can be a community decision. They can decide whether to support a project that allows the mixing of financing or not. So I really urge you to consider that as a potential amendment. Secondly, we strongly recommend that rather than these funds going out under the Workforce Housing Program as a grant, that we adopt what we have found at Minnesota Housing to be a best practice of putting it on the property as a deferred loan. That is, operates very much like a grant. It simply creates a lien on the property that if that property ceases to be residential property in the future, that those dollars would come back to the state of Minnesota and could be recycled. We don't see a lot of these dollars come back, but when there is a dispute, those dollars do come back and are recycled back into the same program. With regard to the governor's initiatives, we were saddened to see that the Homework Starts with Home, $8 million in funding for a proven program of teaming up parents with kids in schools that have experienced homelessness was not included in the bill. We are pleased that you did include $4 million for the CLASS Act, which is a similar proposal, but sadly, that inclusion was at the expense of the development dollars in the Challenge Fund. The net result is that you are looking at a bill that has nearly $9 million less for the development of housing than it had when it started. So with that, I'd like to conclude my remarks and ask if there are any questions.
Thank you for your testimony. Our next testifier, Commissioner Peterson, are you here? Not seeing Commissioner Peterson. How about Dave Bartholomew? Am I getting that right?
And Mr. Chair,
Representative Thiessen.
As he's coming up, is there a sales target if that's not been asked yet for this budget?
A specific sales target or overall? What do you want to elaborate on?
A specific sales target for this budget, yeah. I don't know how to be more specific.
Stand by. Representative Thiessen, speaking with staff here, Ways and Means has not adopted anything like that at this time. If you want a more follow-up, I would suggest you talk to Chair Garofalo.
And Mr. Chair, is there anything,
Representative Thiessen.
Is there anything unofficial?
Well, I am not. At this time, I can't. I'm not going to go there. I'm not going to answer that because if I say yes, then people will say, "Oh, there's an unofficial target." If I say no, they're not going to believe me anyway. Well, folks, on your side. So at this point in the game, we're going to have to wait to see how it goes through Ways and Means, and then if you want to get in, if it goes through Ways and Means, and then a follow up with Representative Chair Garofalo.
And Mr. Chair, I thought we were going to be amending the bill tomorrow, and if we're going to offer amendments, we kind of need to know what the sales target is so we can know what we're doing.
Representative Thiessen, I can get you an answer here before we reconvene.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I hope it will come as no surprise that I'm not David Bartholomew. I'm Josh Tolson.
I'm sorry, a little louder so we got some background.
I'm sorry. I hope it won't come as any surprise to the members of the committee that I am not David Bartholomew. I'm Josh Tolson, the Commissioner of the Bureau of Mediation Services.
Well, thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Yep. I want to thank you for the chance to appear here this morning, and I want to express my deep concern about HF 2209, specifically the impact it will have on all Minnesotans, and urge you to adopt the priorities in the governor's budget, HF 1081. When we talked earlier this session, I provided you an overview of the impact of the work of the BMS on the life of citizens of the state. HF 22 will make it much more difficult for us to continue to make the progress we've made in the last 6 years. The bill will eliminate all funding for the officer collaboration dispute resolution. I spent a great deal of time talking with you about this at my last appearance here. It will walk back recent progress in providing communities, governments, and lawmakers with the opportunity to take advantage of modern problem-solving dispute resolution tools and models to address difficult and controversial matters of public concern. Since its establishment in 2013, OCDR has served as a resource and a catalyst in a number of important high-profile matters affecting large numbers of Minnesotans. Among the most important is the ongoing strengthening of the Minnesota's community mediation agencies. The community mediation programs in Minnesota utilize trained volunteers as mediators who live in the communities they serve. Services are provided at low or no cost to users and save money. Services are provided in the areas of conciliation court, neighborhood disputes, landlord-tenant disputes, family law, restorative justice, conflict resolution, skill building, problem solving and facilitation, business consumer, community policing and police officer training, victim offender resolutions, and in the K-12 system. OCDR's delivery of collaborative solutions and problem-solving services in public policy and other matters of public concern has also become recognized as a valuable public policy resource in a few short years. Examples of some of these projects include the Child Custody Dialogue that many of you are aware of, the Governor's Water Summit, our work with the St. Paul Schools to help them address violence in the schools and with their superintendent search. Also with the Metropolitan Council with their wastewater treatment at the St. Peter Hospital with patient-centered care and worker safety, and with MNSCU on their organizational development issues with the unions. Cutting this program is really short-sighted. I mean, it saves tons of money. It saves litigation costs, and it is a program that really pulls its weight in state government. We've been called in every time there's a crisis in one of these major kinds of events. Another thing that isn't mentioned here is right now we're working in with the dispute between the Mille Lacs Indian Band and the Sheriff's Department, well, actually the County of Mille Lacs, wherein they've been unable to attain an agreement on policing on the reservation. So it's very short-sighted to cut this program. The elimination of the PERB funding is another thing that's in this bill. Since its establishment, PERB has been unable to carry out any of its legislative mission to hear and adjudicate unfair labor practice charges. As a result, employer and unions have had no option but seeking redress in the courts. This is The lack of an administrative remedy makes Minnesota an outlier among states with comprehensive public sector collective bargaining laws. The reason other states have adopted this structure is that court remedies are slow, costly for both government and employee organizations. Now, let me just take a minute to speak about the restrictions on hiring, salary, transfers of money, and billing. You've heard about this from the – my concerns are the same as the other commissioners you've heard from. I don't really need to say too much about this. It limits our agency's authority to engage in cost-saving cooperations both within and without agencies. We are a tiny agency. We've got 14 people. Corrections does all our finance work. I mean, they do all of our transactions and our payroll and everything. And this apparently would make us go out and hire an auditor, which – and then it restricts the number of FTEs we can have. It blocks FTE increases funded by grants and federal dollars or fees, and we've been earning some significant grants from foundations to support the work of the Office for Collaboration and Dispute Resolution. It doesn't provide statutorily for the OCDR PERB, preventing the Bureau from carrying out any of these statutorily mandated functions. And by capping aggregate salaries, it both will conflict with some of the labor agreements, reduce morale, and promote increased turnover. I strongly urge you to reconsider the financial cuts and operating restrictions proposed in this bill, and rather to include the important proposals to strengthen the state that are included in the governor's budget proposal. Now, I'd like to just take a minute to talk about the BMS's budget that's included in the governor's budget. So, first of all, is the BMS operating budget. This is something that was included for all the agencies. It's something in the neighborhood of 2%. For years, we went without any operating budget adjustment. We got a small 1.8% increase 2 years ago. Before that, for years, we went without any, and it's one of the reasons that the size of our agency just shrunk down to as few as 11 employees at one point. Now we're up to a huge 14 employees. So we're a tiny agency, and if we have to offset the cost of all the inflationary costs, both for compensation costs and for other just sort of inflationary costs like our rent. And, you know, we have to rent cars because our guys travel all over the country and so forth. This will just have us reducing our staff again. The OCDR Community Mediation Grant Program I spoke at some length before, but the governor's recommendation is to provide an additional $250,000 each year to support for the community mediation programs that I've mentioned. Also, it finally puts some money in there for PERB to let them open their doors in January of 2017 as the budget, as the statute requires. So, essentially, I urge you to work with together to try to find ways to make this bill better and to conciliate with the governor's office to reach agreements that everybody can sign and we can all continue to do our work together.
Thank you for your testimony.
Thanks a lot. Any questions?
No. Commissioner Ken Peterson, are you here? Commissioner Peterson? All right. We'll move on to our next testifier. It's Tom Chauvin. I believe it's Chauvin or Chauvin. And then on deck, we have Ann, looks like Kilzer. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you. Tom Chauvin. Mr. Chairman, committee members, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I'm here to testify about the $700,000 loan starting on line 4.1 of the bill. I'm a general manager with Republic Services. I've been employed with them for 33 years, starting as a driver. Republic Services has 33,000 employees and operates in 41 states. In Minnesota, our 500 employees provide recycling and waste hauling services, and we are also proud to operate a landfill in Invergrove Heights. Republic has a company-wide focus on recycling. We work hard to collect as many recyclables as possible, even as this directly reduces what comes into our landfill, because it's the right thing to do for the customers and the environment. Our commitment to recycling is backed up by millions of dollars of investments in our two state-of-the-art recycling centers. Last year, we processed over 150,000 tons of material through these two facilities. At the same time, not everything can be recycled. In Minnesota, there's currently two options for waste. The first option is processing waste, burning it to produce energy. Republic has a strong history of supporting Minnesota waste processing. In fact, we are the number one hauler in deliveries to the two of the four area processing facilities. The second option is delivering to a landfill. We also produce renewable energy at Pine Bend, powering over 8,000 homes with electricity each year. Our modern line landfills abides by the highest environmental standards. The environmental protections for the currently operating landfills like Pine Bend are worlds away from unlined landfills which closed decades ago. A comparison of the current metro area rates for waste processing and land disposal clearly show that landfilling is the most cost-effective for the consumer, businesses, the state, both short and long-term. We are here to oppose the provision of this bill, which would directly support a competitor. The item in question is a $700,000 loan for a waste-to-biofuel project in Invergrove Heights. If built, this waste processing facility will directly compete against Pine Bend for waste. We have no objections about competing in the free market. We compete every day with every hauler in the metro area. However, we strongly object to the state picking winners and losers to give a competitor advantage. This is not fair to our business, our employees who work at Pine Bend, including the International Union of Operating Engineers, Local 49. Additionally, we strongly suggest that the state evaluate whether the project is a good investment. The project did not receive a hearing in either the Environmental Committee or the Energy Committee. We haven't had the details on this project, but our understanding that this new technology has not been done at this scale. We ask that the committee remove the provision and take time to evaluate whether this is an appropriate investment.
Thank you for your testimony. Further testimony? Did you have anything?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Your phone a friend. Okay. Members, all right, thank you once again. Thanks again. And up on deck we have here is Ann Kilzer, Director of the Minnesota Workforce Council. Welcome to the testimony. And then we have Charlie Vanderard, if you're on deck. And Commissioner Peterson, are you here? Not seeing Commissioner. Okay, thank you for coming. Please state your name for the record.
Yes, Mr. Chair and members, I'm Ann Kilzer. I'm the director of the Minnesota Workforce Council Association. Our members provide employment and training programs to employers and job seekers in all 87 counties through the statewide system of workforce centers overseen by the 16 local workforce development boards across the state. This committee often touts public-private partnerships, and that's exactly what occurs in the statewide system as our boards are comprised and chaired by members of local employers who provide strategic direction to these locally driven investments. We are very pleased in the strong support in this bill for statewide formula-based programs like the Minnesota Youth Program. The dislocated worker program is maintained rather than decreased relative to other proposals. And we are pleased that investments continue to be made in competitive grant programs, which allow for more targeted services to particular populations or industry sectors and are critical complements to our other formula-funded programs. So with that, we thank you for your work and look forward to continuing discussions as the process moves forward.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Up next, we have Charlie Vanderard, and then on deck, we have Steve Huser. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Charlie Vanderardi with Metro Cities, an association of 91 member cities in the 7-county metro region. Thank you for the opportunity to comment on House File 2209. A priority of Metro Cities this year is restoring the funding of the Minnesota Investment Fund and the Job Creation Fund to the levels the legislature passed in 2015. I would like to thank Representative Howe for his sponsorship of House File 1916, which restores the funding for these important programs that have had success creating jobs across the state. I'd also like to thank Representatives Baker, Neuberger, and May Quaid for their co-sponsorship of the restoration bill. The Minnesota Investment Fund and Job Creation Fund have supported thousands of new jobs in all corners across the state. These programs are proven and competitive and are effective because they have been flexible. And when they have been funded, businesses looking to expand look to Minnesota or stay in Minnesota. Minnesota has modest funding levels for state economic development programs, and restoring these funds would support more jobs and more private investment in Minnesota. Metro Cities appreciates the first steps this bill takes in funding these programs and supports full restoration. While funding is important, flexibility and ability to access the funds is also essential to keep the state competitive with other regions and our neighboring states. The policy language in this bill would severely restrict the use of the Job Creation Fund dollars to only a few parts of the state. 31 counties, including the entire metro region, would be excluded from accessing the Job Creation Fund dollars for businesses looking to expand or locate in Minnesota. This language sets policy without a competitive process. Metro City supports restoring funds for MIF and JCF and to keep the JCF available and accessible to all parts of the state. We also support the redevelopment grant program, which cleans up polluted land so that it can be redeveloped. After last week's 7 grant awards, the fund is now at $0. Metro Cities also urges the committee to fund the challenge program in the Minnesota housing budget in fiscal year 2019. These are dollars that are flexible and oversubscribed. They are used for single-family housing, multifamily housing, rental housing, and owner-occupied housing. Metro Cities also supports the workforce development funds in the bill. The Job Skills Partnership helps incumbent workers retrain for jobs that employers need, and the youth training programs help new workers entering the workforce prepare for their careers. Finally, Metro Cities opposes language in this bill that would require local housing goals to be approved by the legislature. This bill would add legislative oversight of local process and goals. Housing goals are negotiated locally with the Met Council, and Metro City urges the committee to remove this language and recognize the ability of local governments to negotiate with what works well for their communities. Thank you for your time, and I look forward to working with the committee as you go through the budget process, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for your testimony. Were you here? Are you Stephen?
Yes.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record. Now on deck, we have Mr. Bird and Emily Pugh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Stephen Huser. I also represent Metro Cities. Metro Cities respectfully but strongly opposes Article 9, Sections 5 through 19 in this bill. This provision proposes dramatic changes to state laws governing public rights of way by providing unregulated access to wireless providers. These sections would have the effect of eliminating the ability of local units of government to effectively manage public rights of way and ensuring for the health, safety, and welfare of the community. Public rights of way play a vital role in the safe and efficient provision of infrastructure for a local community. Current law enables local governments to have oversight in public rights of way for the purpose of ensuring safe and appropriate uses and managing them. The provisions related to siting on utility poles and other city property would severely hinder the ability of cities to manage issues for which they are responsible in order to ensure appropriate maintenance and management of the right-of-way, community safety, and managing impacts of uses on other city infrastructure, operations, and costs. This bill would give unfettered access to one particular industry and tie the hands of city officials in being able to appropriately manage them. Nothing in current law prohibits the placement of these installations, and cities want new technology in their communities. Many cities have successfully negotiated small cell wireless placement with providers under current laws governing public rights of way. Metro City's policies generally oppose statutory restrictions that impede the ability of local officials to act and protect the best interests of the community. Under this premise, Metro Cities respectfully but strongly oppose these sections and support the removal from House File 2209. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for your testimony. Mr. Chris Bird, welcome to the committee. And we have Emily Pugh on deck, and is Commissioner Ken Peterson here? Not seeing him. Emily Pugh, you're on deck. Mr. Bird, please state your name and welcome. Please state your name for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. I appreciate the opportunity to speak today. My name is Chris Bird, and I'm the Public Works Director and County Highway Engineer for Benton County. But I'm also here today representing the Minnesota County Engineers Association. Our group is comprised of members from all 87 counties, and we are as diverse as our great state. And I'm here to testify in opposition to the small cell wireless legislation that restricts the ability of local governments to manage public rights of way within their jurisdiction. As a county highway engineer, I am tasked with protecting the public road right of way in the interest of safety to the intended primary user, the traveling public. There's no doubt that our roads and streets contain features that are serving a purpose other than the motoring public, but please understand that careful consideration is made in the placement of these features to maintain a high level of safety to motoring, bicycling, and pedestrian public. Counties generally control right-of-way for highways that are suburban and rural in nature. These roads have a distinct feature not existent on urban streets, and that's speed. Devices that are placed in our right-of-way are designed to be able to support themselves and their appurtenances, meaning overhead lights or traffic signal heads or sign panels. But these poles are also designed to be crash-worthy, or in other words, they must break away in the event they are struck by a vehicle. The current proposal defines a small cell wireless support structure to include poles such as a streetlight pole, a traffic signal pole, or even sign poles. This is concerning due to the fact that each of the aforementioned pole types is designed for a specific purpose and not for the purpose of supporting a small wireless facility. Couple that with the bill definition of a small wireless facility to mean a device that can fit into a box that is 6 feet tall, 6 feet wide, and 6 feet deep. Adding a device to a pole and county highway right-of-way that was not originally designed to support can significantly alter the way it reacts during a crash. Section 15, Subdivision 3 in the bill restricts the government unit from specifying which poles may be used to collate wireless facilities. There may be numerous reasons that a wireless facility should not be placed on a pole, ranging from safety concerns to planned construction activities that remove that pole or support structure. The current bill limits the amount of management costs that can be recovered. But analyzing a pole for structural integrity or crashworthiness may require the expertise of outside structural experts. Most county highway departments may not have structural expertise on staff to review different pole types for different wireless devices. The bill has specific language against recovering the cost of a third-party contractor, and this would be additional cost to the county. Furthermore, language in the bill allows for permits for up to 75 small wireless facilities to be submitted in any 1 week. This many permits being received is overly burdensome to many highway departments. Additional language specifies the time frame in which permit must be approved. This would force time and resources to be diverted away from other crucial highway activities to process small wireless facility co-location permit requests. Section 14, Subdivision 3 says that we can't require a permit on a structure not owned by the local government. But we may need to know in that opportunity to review the cases such as this that could lead to additional work in the right-of-way. Additionally, the current proposed language severely limits a county's ability to revoke a permit. But there may be legitimate revocation needed because the government-owned support structure no longer serves a public purpose. An example of this may be a traffic signal-controlled intersection has wireless facilities approved to be mounted in those poles, but that intersection is to be upgraded to a roundabout, and those traffic signal poles will no longer exist. The current proposed language favors the wireless provider and not the owner of the pole. In summary, county right-of-way is meant to facilitate the movement of people, although other facilities do exist. Safety of the public is always paramount when considering placing structures in public right-of-way. Adding devices to structures that are designed for crashworthiness may compromise safety. As a road authority, we need to maintain the ability to review and restrict the placement of some devices on government-owned structures. The county engineers of Minnesota urge the committee to consider alternative language for this type of legislation. And thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. I see that there's one question. Can we give you a quick one? Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to know if you were part of the negotiations and if you're aware of the 23 changes that are coming that address basically everything you just said.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was not directly involved, but the County Engineers Association aligns and supports the League of Minnesota Cities in their efforts with negotiations, and I think that they've primarily been doing the most negotiations on this bill.
Mr. Chair.
Representative O'Neill.
It would be helpful for testimony for whoever else is in the room that they actually address the changes that are on the table as opposed to what's actually in the bill, because almost everything you said has already been addressed. I didn't see any point that you said that wasn't already addressed in these 23 changes that are coming. So just because we have very limited time, and that was a very long testimony, and it was not relevant to the agreed upon, what was agreed upon. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Dabney.
Mr. Chair, did I miss a handout on the 23 changes? Is it in the packet? I'm sorry.
It should be. The pages distributed these. Could the page please bring an extra copy if you need
Thank
one?
Thank you.
We got one. We're good. Thank you. Emily Pugh, welcome to the committee. And on deck we have, after Emily, we have Mr. Mendoza. Emily, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair and members, Emily Pugh with the Association of Minnesota Counties. Thank you.
A little bit louder. Thank you. Use your outside voice.
Thank you for the opportunity to testify this morning. Continued funding for the Border-to-Border Broadband Grant Program, as well as funding for the Office of Broadband Development, is a top priority for counties, cities, and townships across the state. While we understand the committee needs to meet targets, we would appreciate if the committee would consider increased funding for the border-to-border grant program for the next biennium, as well as funding for broadband mapping. Additionally, providing funding for the grant program over both fiscal years allows for better project planning. There is a great amount of support for the program statewide. With last year's $35 million to the program, 42 projects received funding. And we hope you will continue to make broadband funding a priority. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Up after that, we have Mr. Mendoza. Mr. Mendoza, as you're getting settled in there, just see, did Commissioner Peterson, are you available? All right. Never let it be known that the House of Representatives doesn't like their commissioners. Mr. Mendoza, then we have Marie Ellie. You're on deck after Mr. Mendoza. Mr. Mendoza, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr.
Chair. Say your name for the record.
My name is Tony Mendoza. I'm outside counsel to the Minnesota Cable Communications Association. On behalf of the Cable Association, I want to thank the committee and the chair for including the provisions of House File 1665, which reforms regulation of voice over internet services in Minnesota. I'm also here today to testify, though, in opposition to Sections 5 through 19 of Article 9 of the bill relating to small cell wireless technology access to public rights of way. These provisions would grant wireless companies more favorable access to public rights of way than what is afforded to any other telecommunications right-of-way user. This bill fails to take into account the important concerns that have been raised by stakeholders about this bill since its introduction. The Cable Association's primary concern with the legislation is that it discriminates on the basis of technology. It is not competitively neutral. For that reason, the legislation contradicts federal law, which allows local governments to manage public rights of way use by telecommunications service providers, so long as those regulations are non-discriminatory and competitively neutral. This small cell legislation is not competitively neutral. The bill would create a special, streamlined process for accessing public rights of way only for small cell wireless facilities. Other equally important technologies are left out of this special process. This is precisely the type of technology favoritism the Federal Telecommunications Act prohibits. Right-of-way access by telecommunications providers and other utilities is a complex technical issue. If there are going to be changes to the Minnesota Telecommunications Right-of-Way Statute, Cable Association believes those changes should be comprehensive, fair, and equitable to all right-of-way users. In Ohio, a state that has been held up by the wireless industry as a model for Minnesota, the wireless industry did not reach a consensus with stakeholders. Yet the bill was enacted into law over the objections of many stakeholders. And last week, a group of 79 cities sued the state of Ohio over similar legislation. The Cable Association remains opposed to the small cell legislation, and due to the complex and technical nature of the issue, the Cable Association believes this issue requires more careful and thoughtful study and discussion removed from the time pressures of the legislative session. The Cable Association has been at the table from the outset and will continue to work in good faith toward a solution to this issue. But for the reasons cited, we urge you to delete these provisions of the bill. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Marie, I'll take one. Is this something we can do offline or quick? All right, Representative Metza.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just wanted to add in this discussion, I think it sounds like I talked to Representative Hoppe that this may end up getting negotiated out today so more stakeholders get some input. I was contacted by my local cities who would be liable right now under the current legislation. Say a power line fell, knocked off their wireless tower, my city and local community residents would be paying to fix someone else's property. And so I think there's more work that needs to get done. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thank you for your input. And members and ladies and gentlemen, from the public here, just a quick housekeeping note. We are trying to, as you know, we are trying to be respectful, but we are trying to accelerate things as much as we can. If you look at your list right now, we are down to our next testifier is going to be Marie Ellie. We have about, it'll be Commissioner Tilson. Oh, I'm sorry, Commissioner Ken Peterson is here. He'll be next. But members and folks from the public, if you turn the page over, we've got a large list on the back, and I've just been informed we have another list, a supplemental list of at least 20 more people after we get through the back page of this. So if you're wondering why I'm trying to keep things rolling, it's in everyone's interest to do so. So Thank you for your testimony. Commissioner Ken Peterson, welcome to the committee. And then after the commissioner is done, we'll have Marie Ellie. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Ken Peterson. I'm the commissioner of the Department of Labor and Industry. Thank you for the opportunity to be here this morning. And to also like to thank the committee for
Commissioner, please get a little closer to the microphone use your outside voice.
Okay, I'll do that. I want to thank the committee for the opportunity to appear before you, and I want to thank you for proposing to maintain our base budget, granting much of the governor's budget request for the agency, as well as giving DLI, our agency, several additional responsibilities. However, we do have several concerns that I'd also like to share with you today. We do a good job at labor and industry, so we're very pleased there are no reductions in our base budget. We're also pleased you granted a $5.2 million reduction in fees for our construction codes and licensing division, and an additional $250,000 per year was granted to combat wage theft. The additional anti-wage theft funding will allow the department to respond more quickly and effectively to Minnesotans aren't getting paid by their employers for the work they do. We also look forward to being part of the new Helmets to Hard Hats program to help veterans get into apprenticeship programs. It's a great idea, and we're looking forward to our participation in it. At the same time, we'd like you to reconsider the decision not to fund several of the governor's budget requests, as well as proposed limits on effective agency management. I also ask that you consider withdrawing the proposal that would delay implementing the 2018 Minnesota Building Code. The first item we'd like to be reconsidered is the governor's request for a one-time appropriation for a new case management system for DLI's Labor Standards Division. We are working with a system installed in the mid-1980s to handle complaints of wage theft, child labor violations, and other violations of workplace laws. A new system would enable us to do our work much better, so we hope you can consider that. Second, although you have provided the necessary language to make the pipeline project permanent, we are disappointed you're not providing the funds as the governor proposed for the project. As you will recall, this is a work-to-learn, employer-based program that was recognized in 2016 as the state's most successful innovation program. Last session, the project appropriation came from the Higher Education Committee, so we're still hopeful that once again there'll be funding from that source. We applaud the language you provided for Youth Skills Partnership, which would encourage young people to explore well-paid careers that don't require 4 years of college. However, the necessary funding for that program was also not included in the bill. We're very concerned with the inclusion of House File 1001 in the bill. It would require legislative committees' approval of any proposed administrative rule increases, any proposed administrative rule that would increase the cost of a new home by more than $1,000. Although the bill applies to all executive branch rulemaking, the adoption of the Minnesota State Building Code with its minimum safety standards would be affected the most. The bill's chief problem is a delay adopting new code. By statute, a building code must be adopted in 2 years, or the code process must start over. The extra time required for legislative study, review, deliberation, and debate will make that deadline much more difficult to make. In many cases, in fact, it will be hard to objectively determine whether a given provision adds to or cuts costs, particularly when coupled with other parts of the code, or when cost savings from some code provisions may be realized later by the homeowner, such as the case with energy efficiency provisions. The result of having to start codes over and over again will be that homebuyers will be denied any cost savings and other safety or technology advantages provided by a new code. Finally, I'd like to discuss the bill's restrictions on good management. By most metrics of customer responsiveness and efficiencies in production, the Department of Labor and Industry has been quite successful the last 7 years. We have cut fees, we have improved services, we have fewer staff. I'm afraid those sorts of improvements that we've been able to make will be more difficult to achieve under the management restrictions contained in the bill. The restrictions include bans on internal transfers, internal billing, division by division limits on total compensation, employee numbers, and external fund transfers. We urge you drop those constraints on good management from the bill. Thank you very much, members. Appreciate your time.
Yep, thank you for your testimony, Commissioner. On deck, next up we have Marie Ellie. On deck will be Andy Emerson. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Marie Ellis, and I'm the Director of Public Affairs and Legal Counsel for the St. Paul Area Chamber of Commerce. And I'm here today to talk about the portion of your omnibus bill that deals with small cell technology.
Mic. Thank you.
Thank you. I usually am told I'm too loud, so maybe this will work out for me. I'm here today to talk about the portion of your omnibus bill that deals with small cell technology. The St. Paul Area Chamber of Commerce strongly supports this legislation as an important step to positioning Minnesota to embrace the next generation of technologies that drive our economy. We all know, and I think this room is a prime example, that businesses and people are relying more and more on faster technologies and more smaller devices to get their work done and to connect to the world around them. That technology is really becoming critical to the success of our communities. Technology drives business, and a healthy business community is vital to the success of Minnesota. Our businesses and our employees expect wireless networks to keep up with the demand of faster technologies. One of the ways that wireless companies can keep up with that demand is by deploying small cell technology. Small cells help to enhance wireless networks, and in doing so, bring faster speeds and a better overall wireless experience. For Minnesota to continue to attract new talent and business, we need to stay on the cutting edge of advancement, and small cell technology is that cutting edge. And with respect to some previous testimony, I'd just like to add that our experience is that some cities are not welcoming this new technology, and hence the need for this legislation. So I just will conclude by saying thank you for including that language in your omnibus bill.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Up next, we have Mr. Andy Emerson, and then on deck, we have Paul Wirtz, Andy? Representative Makewood.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are we going to be asking questions of folks at the end of all of this?
There will be time. We will have member questions when we're done with public testimony. If there's a bill that we have not heard, I will be flexible and entertain a few questions if they cannot be taken offline. Just out of respect to everyone's schedules here, we've got to finish the front of this list. We've got to finish the back of this list. And then staff just showed me we have at least 20 more after that. So long answer to your short question, yes, I'll take questions if it's a bill that we have not heard, as long as it's something that needs to be answered here and not offline.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate
that. You're welcome.
That.
Mr. Emerson, please state your name for the record. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, I'm Paul Wirtz. I'm the state president for AT&T Minnesota. I'm going to introduce my colleague, Mr. Andy Emerson. He's with the law firm of Porter Wright, if that's okay. Yep. I just have a few opening comments with respect to the small cell legislation. We certainly appreciate the committee's attention on this important piece of legislation and investment opportunity for Minnesota. What you have in front of you, Representative O'Neill pointed out, is the more than 23 changes. I understand that there's an amendment that will be forthcoming with additional changes. We've been meeting with the stakeholders for more than 4 months, the League of Cities, county engineers, numerous local government stakeholders, trying to allay these concerns. I think what you're hearing is really testimony from the original bill and not reflective of the additional changes. I would like to point out, and Mr. Emerson worked very closely on this Ohio legislation that was talked about earlier by our friends in the cable industry. Both the cable industry there and the municipal league were neutral on that bill. Now, that doesn't say that cities have disagreements with legislation, and there was a myriad of things in that omnibus package that why that's being challenged in Ohio. But, I'm sure the city of Cleveland is grateful for the $350 million we've invested in the city there. But nevertheless, I also know that you have a VoIP provision in front of you that the cable industry, and we certainly support that, but it seems a little contradictory to argue for 21st century regulatory parity on internet protocol services and try to allay a 1970s franchise regulatory structure on 5G wireless going forward. The cable industry has been very clear about its desire to get into 5G, and just today, because this technology is moving at the speed of sound, will Comcast offer nationwide online TV services? They're going to be competing directly with DirecTV, with our online service, with YouTube TV, which is coming on. People want competition for their cable service. It's going to be brought wirelessly. So, I think, it'll be interesting to see if they argue for those franchise agreements where those cities where they're out of franchise, if you will. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'll turn it over to my colleague, Andy Emerson, to talk about the numerous changes we've made to the bill.
Thank you for your testimony. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you. Andrew Emerson, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm a lawyer at Porterwright, Morrison, Arthur in Columbus, Ohio, and I represent AT&T on small cell matters nationwide. And as Mr. Wirtz mentioned, I've spent the last couple months working with the League of Minnesota Cities and the cable industry and other stakeholders to negotiate amendments to the bill. You've got in your packets a number, 23 of them, and there's five additional ones in terms of work we've done in the Senate that we're willing to do. And I guess I'll just leave that in the interest of time. We can look at those materials. I want to hit a couple points, though, that have been brought up already. You have heard that, why do anything? You can already put small cells up under the existing law. I think it's important for everyone to understand that right now, when AT&T shows up at a city's door, you could get 850 different answers in Minnesota in terms of access, rent, okay, or zoning laws. That's not a way to encourage investment. And so the whole premise of this bill is to create a uniform set of rules to encourage this investment in Minnesota. So that's an important thing to point out right at the outset. And these things are important because rent, for instance, there is no fair market value for this. I'm working on 26 other bills in other states right now, and there's all of them have some sort of cost-based formula for rent, whether it's the FCC's formula or some, estimate that's appropriate for that. So that's important to understand. They all have a universal permitted use. So that's, you don't have 850 different answers for the zoning law. Couple other items I want to address just because they've come up. I think one representative mentioned over here an indication from a city that, what about liability issues? I want to make it clear that any permit that's issued for a small cell would have terms and conditions for indemnification or liability in the permit. This is not stripping the cities of any of that. If they have it in their existing ordinances, it would remain. They can cite to it. They could put it in the permit. They could enter into a separate agreement. This bill does not preclude that sort of negotiation from occurring and certainly being in the bill. The definition of what of the actual wireless support structure, it's been mentioned that that's too broad. I want to make it clear that we've specifically tailored it so that it was specific and addressed, what structures would be eligible for a attachment. Just the mention that the County Engineers Association brought up, I think it's important to understand that nothing in this bill strips a local entity's ability to deny a permit for a small cell if there's a structural integrity issue, if there's any generally applicable health, safety, or welfare concern. They could still deny a bill on those things. There's two different sections within the permitting section that deal specifically with this. So I want to make that clear. There was a concern raised about, or that you may hear about restocking of these poles because some of them can be unique. There was a concession put in the bill to have restocking language associated with as a condition of approval to any permit. So if it was a specialty pole that was placed in a right-of-way, that if the city had a restocking requirement for other occupiers of the public way, that, they would be able to require that also. One other issue, or two other issues, and then I'll stop. There was mentioned that the shot clock in this bill was too short at 60 days. We changed that to 90 days. So that's 30 more days than under existing Minnesota law right now for wireless facilities. Lastly, I just wanted to touch on, and Mr. Wirtz touched on a little bit, in terms of the cable opposition to this bill. You heard some testimony earlier that somehow this creates an unlevel playing field. Somehow there's new rules or something. First of all, the definition of a telecom right-of-way user in existing law here that this amends allows cable or any other occupier the same exact process if they're going to put similar equipment up in the right-of-way. So that's a farce. I just want to point that out. You can look at it. It's right there in the bill. And lastly, as Mr. Wirtz mentioned, I did negotiate the Ohio bill, and I can tell you that we were able to resolve all these issues with both the cities and the cable industry. I'm happy to take any questions, Chairman.
Representative Metzo, we did hear this bill in committee. Is this something brief?
I was just going to ask, will the testifiers be around later for questions?
To the testifiers.
Mr. Chairman, absolutely.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you, Representative Metzo. I appreciate that. Next up, we have Mr. J. Littlejohn. Are you available? Thank you for coming here today. And on deck, we have, it just says the Minnesota Glass Association. I'm assuming that's not your name, whoever that is, if you're available. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Jay Littlejohn.
I'm a zoning and land use attorney with Moss and Barnett in Minneapolis, representing Verizon Wireless in the state, both greater Minnesota and the metro area, for 29 years. It's been said that the bill strips the city of its regulatory authority. If you read the bill, you'll see that that's just not the case. What it does is it moves for these very small cells, moves the decision-making from the public arena with hearings and gobs of information to the gobs of information going to the permitting authorities, the same people that now decide whether a particular light pole should be in a particular spot, a particular power pole, cable pole could be in that area. All the bill does is move that out of the zoning area and into the permitting area. There's no stripping of any authority. The same kinds of regulations that would apply to power lines, would apply to light poles, would also apply to these small wireless facilities. What it does do is it opens up the ability of these companies to install these small facilities on poles that the cities already have in place. Specifically requires that if a pole current won't hold the facilities right now, all the city has to do is put in the permit, replace the pole, and the companies have to do it at their own cost. The current legislation, the 237, 162, and 163, already has an appeal process in place so that if when a telecommunications right-of-way user seeks a permit and is denied, the person, the wireless company or the wireline company can appeal. But that should be the exception, not the rule, and that's why this bill is being proposed. That's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Up next we have, it just says, Minnesota Glass Association. Is there anyone here for that? Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please state your names for the record. And then on deck after these gentlemen, we have, it looks like, Mr. Todd Hill. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
My name is Rick Rosar with Rapid Glass, and I represent the Minnesota Glass Association.
My name is Brad Hapka with Only One Auto Glass and also with the Minnesota Glass Association.
Thank you. Proceed with your testimony.
We represent all auto glass companies across the state of Minnesota. We're here in opposition of Section 4, Article 8, Section 4 of the insurance adjuster language. We know many of you have heard from our members and other glass shops across the state. Although Safe Light Auto Glass is the biggest auto glass company in the United States, independent glass shops have no problem competing with them. The problem is that Safe Light owns a claims processing division that refers work to themselves. This is a huge conflict of interest and the reason for many of our current laws. Some of the current laws written to protect consumers from unfair claims practices are in 72A.201, it's unlawful to failing to provide payment to the insured's chosen vendor based on a competitive price that's fair and reasonable, by not providing an advisory statement that allows consumers to choose their shop of choice and prohibits pressuring the consumer, requiring that the repair or replacement be made by a particular place or shop, engaging in any practice, intimidation, coercion, threat, incentive, or inducement. Changing the law would remove these and other consumer protections because the state would no longer have the authority or oversight to correct the offending actions without Safe Light and others being licensed. Another reason we are asking you to remove the language from the bill is because Safe Light handles the insurance claims process from the first notice of loss to the final payment. On most auto glass claims, the insurance company or agent never interacts with the consumer from the beginning to the end of the entire process. The customer calls the 800 number on their insurance card, and they believe they're talking to their insurance company. However, the call goes directly to Safe Light. The customer's shop of choice is also forced to call Safe Light for authorization, another huge conflict of interest. Safe Light collects confidential customer information. Safe Light determines the severity of the damage. Safe Light informs the customer of the pricing and their deductible. The glass shop sends their invoice to Safe Light, and claims payments come directly from Safe Light. They are obviously acting like an insurance adjuster. So now instead of complying with current laws, this Safe Light-sponsored bill, which Safe Light wants to change, it thereby bullying customers, making bullying customers legal without any repercussions. The current insurance adjuster laws were developed to protect consumers and small businesses. It makes no sense to remove consumer protection for the benefit of one company. If all SafeLight is doing is data entry, then the current laws would exclude them from being licensed anyways. This isn't about the big guy versus the little guy. This is about protecting Minnesota residents. More discussion may be needed in dealing with this. It's been going on for many years. But this bill is not the proper vehicle or place to do this issue any justice. If SafeLight isn't adjusting claims, then there would be no need to change the law at all. However, they know they are adjusting claims, which is why they are sponsoring this language. So we would just like to ask you to remove the insurance adjuster language from this bill and protect consumer rights. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Sir, did you have additional testimony?
No, thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Todd Hill, you're up. And then on deck we have Mr. Chris DeLaForest. Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record.
Yeah, thank you, Chairman. For the record, my name is Todd Hill with Hill Capital Strategies, and I'm here on behalf of my client, SafeLight Auto Glass. My client apologizes for not being here today, but came down with a case of pneumonia and was unable to fly and be here for this meeting. I'm here to thank the committee and the chairman for including the provisions from Representative Smith's bill, House File 1947, in the omnibus bill. It's Section 4, Article 8. I would ask you to oppose any efforts to take this language out of the omnibus bill. While the testimony of the Auto Glass Association was compelling, it really has nothing to do with the language that is in this bill today. Allegations of steering and unfair competition are not addressed by this language. This language is simply an effort by SafeLight Auto Glass to reach a resolution with the Department of Commerce over the issue of adjusting. I'm sure many of you are well aware we've had a number of cases we've been litigating with the Department of Commerce over the course of the last 2 years. We recently were awarded a judgment in federal court and on a separate issue, and most recently I've been dealing with this issue of adjusting. In 2002, the Department of Commerce investigated this issue, subpoenaed SafeLight Auto Glass, and did a thorough investigation of whether or not we were actually adjusters in the process that we use. We are simply a third-party administrator for the insurance companies. And in 2002, the Department of Commerce came back and said, you're not adjusters, and we have operated with no changes since that time. 49 other states in the country don't view what we do as a third-party administrator as adjusting. This language simply is trying to clarify state law using language that the Department of Commerce brought forward in a situation with the administrative law judge recently, and just trying to clarify that exactly what we do as a third-party administrator is not adjusting a claim. It doesn't take away any consumer protection. It doesn't change how non-network shops can bill. Nothing changes in the way that we operate today. If this language is taken out, we will just continue to fight the Department of Commerce and the ALJ process. We do have an opinion from the ALJ that was very clear in the ALJ's opinion that what we do is not adjusting. And if the language was to come out of the bill, we'll continue to operate as a third-party administrator. We'll continue to go through the ALJ process and likely end up litigating this issue if the Department of Commerce continues to pursue this. But I just want to point out that the other issues that were brought up today are really irrelevant to the discussion about adjusting. This is just an effort by us to try and resolve an issue with the Department of Commerce, and we would ask that you not support an effort to take that language out of this bill.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Mr. DeLaForest, you're up, and then on deck we have, it looks like, Patrick Ness. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, good morning. For the record, Chris DeLaForest representing SKB Environmental and their partner, Enerchem. I'm pleased to offer just some brief testimony, really in rebuttal to previous testimony from Republic Services regarding the waste to biofuels project proposed for Invergrove Heights. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, in overview, this project will actually employ $200 million in private investment, leveraging that $700,000 that was referred to. That will result in many thousands of hours of construction jobs on the site, as well as approximately 104 to 110 stay-behind jobs once the project is finished. Be clear, this is a waste-to-biofuels project, so clearly and proudly, the intent of this project is to divert waste from landfills to this project that will use a proprietary technology to turn that waste into biofuels like methanol and ethanol. And what is proprietary about it, in part, is that it will not combust this waste. It will not use a combustion process. more than that, to give you just a little bit of overview about what the public infrastructure piece of this is that this project also in innovative fashion will not use any natural water. As many of you know, converting anything into ethanol, for example, requires a lot of water. This project will use strictly effluent water from the Met Council. My clients have been in deep conversations with Met Council Environmental Services about how we are going to get an extension of the primary effluent pipe running through Dakota County in the Rosemount area just a little bit north into my client's site, which is also a closed landfill, by the way, so that would be repurposed, thereby also increasing greatly, exponentially, we think, the tax base for the city of Inver Grove Heights at maybe about $1.5 million per year. I'd also apologize, Mr. Chairman, you members of the committee, this was not a bill. That was in part because of timing issues that we've been working with, specifically with Met Council, regarding what it might cost to do all this. And so I would just add for the record, Mr. Chairman, I know you're pressed for time. Of course, it's the will of the committee to ask questions. I'd be happy to answer, but I'm also pleased to meet with any member of the committee offline. And if you're interested, we'd like to take you to Edmonton. It's one final point I would make is that this is not theoretical. This is not a process that exists only on a professor's desk somewhere. The city of Edmonton has a commercial scale project that Enerkem operates right now. In the near future, another facility will come online just outside Montreal. And so we're very excited that, at least in the United States, this could be the first project of its kind in the country. Mr. Chairman, thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Representative Thiessen.
Thanks. So what's the money for?
Mr. DeLaForest.
So Mr. Chairman and Representative Thiessen, primarily what the money is for is to get the extension from the effluent pipe that runs through Dakota County up to and into SKB's site in Inver Grove Heights.
Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so is that going to be your property then, that pipe, or then or the Met Council property?
Mr. DeLaForest.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Thiessen, that's a good question. It could be either. That is something that will have to be worked out with Met Council and primarily attorneys. We have been in contact with our partners with Met Council, Deed, PCA to determine exactly how that works. Part of the timing issue here that we're dealing with is that the city of Inver Grove Heights is going to engage in a major reconstruction and utility realignment project very near the site, first quarter of 2018. And obviously it is going to make taxpayers very unhappy in Inver Grove Heights if we ask to go back to rip up those streets later on to get this pipe in. So to be clear, what the timing issue is about specifically here is that section that would run through the city of Inver Grove Heights. Again, we're unfortunately dealing with some difficult timing issues between the city, Met Council, and ourselves.
Representative Thiessen, follow up?
No, I can talk to Chris.
Again, please follow up offline. Thank you for your testimony. Appreciate that.
Mr. Chairman, thank you.
Up next, we have, trying to decipher my list here, Patrick Ness. Welcome to the committee. And then on deck, we have Ken Smith. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Ness. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Patrick Ness with the Wilder Foundation. I'm here representing the Class Act Coalition, which is the group of pilot sites who worked on the rental assistance for families of homeless and highly mobile students, as well as the Homes for All Coalition, a group of 170 organizations across the state working to make sure every person has a place to call home. I want to thank the committee for inclusion of $4 million in one-time funding for the Class Act. And to specifically thank the co-authors on the committee, Representatives O'Neill, Baker, Fabian, Moran, Dabney, May Quaid, Metza, Rarick, Thiessen, and Clark. The pilot launched on the ground in January of 2014 with three pilot sites. It has been a success both on housing indicators and on reducing chronic absenteeism for students who are in the program. You heard in committee from Arviance and Carnita, two parents whose families have been really given a launching pad for stability and success both in the child's life and in the classroom, but also at home. I went up to Dilworth and heard from a mom, Lucy, who has three children. They were able to double up in a friend's home, but it was not a good situation. They spent all of their time either in school or at the park. She cooked their dinner in the park, made breakfast in the park. They would do their homework in the park. in Dilworth, Minnesota. Looking forward, the original request is $10 million in base funding. We've been grateful for 2 years or two bienniums of pilot. We have the results. We stand by those, and we feel like it's a good long-term investment for the state. Also want to lift up, in housing, there's a full continuum from prevention and street outreach to building affordable housing, and it all matters for kids. And so we need rental assistance. We also need to make sure we continue building housing. And so we would like to see that the Minnesota housing budget stay whole, including the challenge fund and increase the class act. In closing, right before I got up, I was just reflecting. There are two situations happening right now. One is my first job out of college. I worked for Sharing and Caring Hands and Mary Jo Copeland, and every Monday morning at 10 a.m. right around now, families would line up seeking shelter, and the kids would be in front of us, and most we had to say no to because we were full every day. And then there's other kids in this state who woke up in their own apartment, their own home, and they're at school, and they're focusing on learning to read and learning their math. And that is the difference in experience that you have before you. Thank you for your inclusion, and look forward to working with you.
Thank you for your testimony. Mr. Ken Smith, and then on deck we'll have Mr. Rob Wolfington. Mr. Smith, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Ken Smith. I'm the CEO of District Energy St. Paul, and I am here today on behalf of the St. Paul Cogeneration. In my capacity as a board member and a District Energy St. Paul thermal customer of St. Paul Cogeneration, we are commenting in opposition to language in House File 2209 that repeals the Minnesota Statute Section 216B2424, also known as the biomass mandate. I agree with Chair Garofalo that it is important to have a conversation about the use of biomass in Minnesota. The Energy Information Agency reports that biomass is used to generate approximately 3% of all of Minnesota's electricity. Similarly, Xcel Energy reports on its website that about 3% of its power comes from biomass energy in all forms. That biomass includes clean woody biomass like St. Paul Cogeneration uses, and also refuse-derived fuel and other sources. While all forms of biomass are used to fuel a relatively small percentage of the total power generation in the state, it is also clearly an important resource that we have an abundance of, particularly in the form of wood. It is also a complex energy source with many facets and market drivers that need to be examined when considering the adjustment to policies, depending upon the kind of biomass it is, the source of it, and how it generates useful energy. St. Paul Cogeneration is the owner and operator of a 33-megawatt biomass-fired combined heat and power plant that was developed in response to the biomass mandate that resulted from the 1994 Prairie Island Agreement. After reaching agreement on the PPA in 1998, over $60 million of private investment was used to develop and construct the plant. There are 6 years left on the current PPA with Xcel Energy. As a combined heat and power plant, St. Paul Cogeneration generates both heat and electricity, and the plant combusts clean biomass to generate 25 megawatts of renewable electricity that is sold to Xcel, and renewable heat that is used to generate hot water for District Energy St. Paul District Heating Systems. Using the heat that is produced during the generation of electricity enables this plant to achieve efficiencies that are nearly twice that of standard power plants that only generate electricity. Many of the biomass plants do just that, generate just electricity. The plant that was designed was also designed to operate much like a fossil fuel baseload facility with high reliability and availability and capacity factor. This is different than other renewables like wind and solar. St. Paul Cogeneration is integrated into the district energy system in downtown St. Paul that provides heating to over 31 million square feet. It is the largest hot water district energy system in North America. The heating customers are small to large and includes all of the downtown hospitals, the state capitol complex, and facilities of companies like Ecolab, Travelers, and Securian. As the primary source of thermal energy used by district energy to heat 200 downtown buildings, St. Paul Cogeneration is considered critical infrastructure and crucial part of an integrated energy system serving the central business district. St. Paul Cogeneration's primary source of biomass is clean wood waste that results from severe storms, disease, including emerald ash borer, which we're seeing more of now, and tree trimmings. It combusts approximately 270,000 tons of wood waste annually. Over the past 5 years, wood waste from over 115 communities in and around the Twin Cities metro was used to fuel the combined heat and power plant, and of that, the 16 counties in the greater MSP region accounted for approximately 82% of the locally derived wood waste. In the 1990s, the Twin Cities metro was challenged with finding an effective way to orderly dispose of substantial quantities of wood waste. That was one of the key reasons it was selected as a fuel source for St. Paul Cogeneration when it was developed. Wood waste is and will continue to be a problem for the state and local governments. Cities and counties should also be concerned with this legislation, which would jeopardize a valuable resource for the safe and reliable disposal of the region's waste wood. We provide an important service to the communities that depend upon it. Removing it as an outlet for this material will cost local governments and businesses hundreds of thousands of dollars of additional costs to dispose of this material generated in the region. The local economic impact of the facility is substantial. In addition to providing thermal energy used to heat buildings in downtown St. Paul and helping local businesses and communities manage their wood waste, St. Paul Cogeneration currently puts approximately $15 million into the local economy in the form of jobs, contractors, and equipment. Additionally, the integrated energy system serving downtown St. Paul is globally recognized and has attracted many dignitaries, energy experts, and thousands of visitors from around the globe. Repealing the biomass mandate could have a serious impact on our current PPA and important services that the downtown St. Paul buildings and region depend on it to provide. Repealing the mandate would definitely impact our ability to have meaningful negotiations with Xcel Energy to amend or extend the PPA with terms that are mutually beneficial and more cost-effective, a conversation that SPC, St. Paul Cogeneration, has already begun with Xcel Energy. During this time of unprecedented change in the energy system, it is important to look at the role of all energy sources we have available to us as a state, including biomass, and the policies we are using to govern their use. We look forward to participating in such a conversation. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members, for the opportunity to share this testimony.
Thank you for your testimony. Mr. Wolfington, you're up, and then Mr. Tom Kuntz, you're on deck. Mr. Wolfington, welcome, Mayor. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. My name is Rob Wolfington. I serve as a city manager in Benson.
I stand corrected.
Benson is a community of 3,200. We are located in west central Minnesota. Benson is home to Benson Power, LLC, more commonly known as Fibromen. Benson Power is a 55-megawatt baseload power plant that combusts turkey litter and other clean vegetative biomasses as a fuel. Our community was alarmed to House File 759 when we learned that if the bill were to become law, it would allow Xcel Energy to buy out the Benson Power LLC contract and perhaps shutter the plant. Benson has embraced the plant. We've built our economy around the plant, and we've made substantial public improvements in support of the plant. Benson Power LLC employs 120 people, if you include the direct plant operators, truck drivers, and fuel and fertilizer handlers. Those 120 folks have donated their youth to that plant. They've built their careers around the plant and are very nervous about its future. We're asking the community to carve out the Benson plant from the bill and allow the plant to find ways to improve its efficiency and satisfy the investments that the community have made over the years. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Mr. Kuntz, Tom Kuntz, welcome to the committee. On deck, members, we're going to see where we're at with time. We've got about 12 minutes before we have to be in session. Mr. Kuntz, Mayor, welcome to the committee. And also, please state your, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Yep, my name is Amanda Dewar, and I'm the government relations representative for the Minnesota Municipal Utilities Association. I'm just going to provide some brief comments and turn it over to Mayor Kuntz. MMUA is very disappointed to see that this bill includes the wireless provider's proposal restricting municipalities' right-of-way management authority to achieve access to utility poles, streetlights, and other public assets for the siting of small cell facilities. At every committee stop, the bill author has noted that nobody likes this bill. That remains true today. He asked stakeholders to try to find peace in the valley. Yet the wireless providers walked away from the negotiations, which MMUA has been actively involved in. So we're here today with this controversial and potentially unsafe proposal in this omnibus bill. And though I haven't seen a copy of the handout that the providers referenced, I can assure you that I am testifying on the current language that is in the bill. I'll enumerate some of our concerns. The bill expressly prohibits local governments from adopting limitations on height, placement, and minimum separation distances, which is laid out under the National Electric Safety Code. The limitation of third-party contractors, which the counties reference, do the structural and engineering review of many of these facilities is problematic. And further, MMUA strongly opposes being tied to the FCC pole attachment formula, which municipalities are exempt from at the federal level. So with me today is Owatonna Mayor Tom Kuntz. He has the unique perspective of not only being an elected official, but before that, the general manager of Owatonna Public Utilities. So I'll turn it over to him to discuss the local authority and safety concerns in this
bill. Welcome to the committee, Mayor. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair and committee members, my name is Tom Kuntz, Mayor of the City of Owatonna. As a city, all the rules and regulations that get put on by the state or by the federal government really come back down to the city to implement and to make sure they get directed the right direction. And with that, the city of Owatonna felt it was in its best interest to pass a resolution. And the resolution reads, Council approved of Resolution 22-17 opposing legislation that would severely limit local authority to manage small cell technology in public right-of-ways. The city has been informed that cities, private wireless and cellular service providers are pushing legislation that would allow unregulated access to public right-of-ways for installation of small cell wireless equipment and distribution antenna systems. This legislation would supersede existing zoning ordinances and comprehensive plans that have been in place for years. This legislation provides automatic approval that would not allow for cities to consider the effects of public health, safety, and aesthetics. Being a general manager, our public utilities is in the process of removing a lot of the distribution overhead lines and putting them underground, allowing somebody to come back in and put a pole where we've just removed all those poles without our permission, without our access, would not sit our citizens very well. Another thing is with permit process, I've had companies come in and put underground stuff in and not really clean up the area. If you have a permit, you can come back to the permit process and call that company up and say, this is your permit. You need to come repair the area that you just put in. So I think it's in the best interest of the city and the cell phone providers to work together to find solutions. We're not against going to 5G. I think that's necessary for all cities in the state of Minnesota, but we are against having them have unlimited access to the right-of-ways without any approval.
Thank you for your testimony, members. If you heard like I did, there was the short warning sound that just went out for session. It's about to start. Representative O'Neill, did you have something quick that you wanted to add?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I do. And again, the testimony is not through the changes. And so one thing that you had mentioned specifically was the FCC pole attachment cost formula, which has been removed in the agreement. There's 23 additional changes and 5 past this, which I don't have. But if the testifiers in the room could please testify to the, and I don't even have the five past the 23, but it would definitely speed things up and not have redundant testimony that's irrelevant to the changes.
May I respond to that? At least
to the testifier.
At least in the language that is in the bill, the FCC poll attachment language is in that. I have not seen that agreement, and I have been involved in every negotiation, so if there's a list of 23 things, perhaps it's forthcoming in an amendment, but I assure you I'm speaking to the bill.
Representative O'Neill, you get the final word.
Just very quickly, I mean, I understand that you're speaking to the language in the bill itself, but there's 23 agreed upon provisions with five past this, which I don't have. That's what they just testified to. So instead of having testimony to the bill language, it would be helpful to have testimony to what the agreement was so we don't waste time. That's all I want to say.
Thank you for your testimony. Members and member of the public, we are going to be recessing to the call of the chair. Approximately, I'm going to say 20 to 25 minutes after session concludes. With that, we stand in recess. We'll reconvene the Job Growth and Energy Affordability Committee. We'll continue with our public testimony. Going off the list here, we have for the Commission of the Deaf, Deaf, Blind, and Hard of Hearing Minnesotans, we have Beth Frazier and Mary Hartnett, and then on deck will be Aaron Dady. Are any of these individuals here? Hi, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Hello, my name is Mary Hartnett. I'm the Executive Director of the Commission of Deaf, Deaf, Blind, and Hard of Hearing Minnesotans, and I want to thank the chair, and I want to thank our chief author, Representative Baker, for introducing this important piece of legislation. 20% of the state's population has a hearing loss that's significant enough that it impedes their ability to be able to communicate and understand, and the funds that we will be, that we were thankfully received will allow us to continue our work on age-related hearing loss to try to get more and more professionals to provide screenings and training on how to respond to elder adults with hearing loss and to work with kids. We convene a statewide education conference that works cross-agency with nonprofits and with parents to provide the latest research on how to intervene and improve outcomes for kids and continue to distribute our information on our website in American Sign Language. So we're very thankful. We would not have been able to continue to do this important work. Thank you for all of our co-authors who signed on, and just want to say thank you very much for including us in this legislation.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Do you know if Beth Frazier is here?
This is Mary Harnett. We were just trading off. We worked together with the same commission.
So we'll take her off the list.
Okay, yes, you may take her off.
Thank you. Aaron Dady or Daddy? Dady. Welcome to the committee. And then 1 second here. On deck, who do we have? Is it? On deck, we will have Chad Schwitters, and then after Chad, it's going to be Senta Leff. But welcome to the committee, Aaron. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Aaron Dady, and I'm a volunteer board member with Twin Cities Habitat for Humanity. We're an active member within the Homes for All Coalition, a network of over 170 community-based organizations, faith communities, developers, schools, local government units, and concerned citizens advocating together for safe and affordable housing statewide. Thank you for the opportunity to testify about House File 2209 today. With a very low target you received, your committee had to make some tough choices in assembling your bill. Our coalition is very pleased that you included some funding for the CLASS Act, Representative Crenshaw's bill, to support highly mobile students with stable housing. Pilot results demonstrate that this targeted intervention stabilizes families, lowers school absenteeism, and boosts the academic performance of homeless students. We are also appreciative that there were no cuts to base funding for affordable housing programs that have a strong track record of assisting Minnesotans in finding and keeping affordable housing statewide. We're very concerned, however, about the elimination of Challenge Fund resources for the second year of the 2018-19 biennium. The Challenge Fund is the primary vehicle for creating new affordable housing in urban, rural, and suburban communities throughout Minnesota. In fact, this resource is the only state funding that Habitat organizations statewide access, and it very successfully leverages private donations and volunteers who partner with local families in the building of their own homes.
A loss of 12 months of challenge funding greatly decreases the production of the affordable homes that we and other developers produce to meet the growing demand, particularly in areas with increased job growth. For example, in 2016, the Challenge Fund supported the development of 281 housing units in the 7-county metro area, but even more in greater Minnesota, 295 units. In 2015, the Challenge Fund supported 223 housing units in the metro, and again more in greater Minnesota, 288 units. We hope that this body remains open to maintaining the strong impact of the Challenge Fund in communities statewide as you continue your discussion of this bill in the coming weeks. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members of the committee.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Chad Schwitters, are you here? All right. After Chad, if he's not here, we have Senta Leff and then Dave Schaefer. You're on deck. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Senta Leff. I am the Executive Director of the Minnesota Coalition for the Homeless and co-chair of the Homes for All Coalition. As you've just heard, Homes for All is a statewide coalition made up of more than 170 organizations. We represent every legislative district in the state. We are made up of local government, faith-based organizations, nonprofit service providers, and private housing developers. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today, and thank you for your support of the CLASS Act. The one-time funding contained in your bill will help take the pilot project statewide. And as we know, and I'm sure you've heard many times, stable housing for children ensures the positive outcomes in their education and serves as an essential building block for breaking the cycle of poverty. And as you just heard, our coalition is concerned about the zeroing out of the Challenge Fund in 2019. The Challenge Fund requires and leverages private matching dollars, which are used to build and preserve affordable housing across the state. What I want to leave you all with today is just that where we live impacts every aspect of our lives. Affordable housing is central to jobs and the growing economy and is critical to kids' success at school. Minnesota is leading the nation in its reduction of homelessness. We've seen a 9% decline over the past 3 years. And this is not thanks only to an economic recovery. Communities with similar economic recoveries have not seen the same decline in their homeless populations. It's only when paired with targeted investments, such as the ones that the Homes for All Coalition has proposed. So as you move forward through the legislative process, please keep in mind our homeless neighbors and students. There are more than 7,000 homeless folks across the state, and today, as we sit here in this room, there are more than 10,000 public school kids who are in a classroom but don't have a place to sleep tonight. So thank you for the opportunity to testify. Appreciate your time.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Real quick, is Chad Schwitters here? Chad Schwitters? All right, not seeing Chad. We're going to move on to Dave Schaefer and then Martin Maroud. Maroud is on deck. Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is David Schaefer. I'm with the Minnesota Solar Energy Industries Association, or MNSEA. MNSEA is a 501c6 nonprofit trade organization that represents solar installers, developers, manufacturers, and other solar-related businesses. Today I'm here to talk about two different parts of this bill. The first is the Made in Minnesota program, and then is also the PACE portion of the bill. The general message I want to convey is one around business certainty. Our members established businesses here under Made in Minnesota with a reasonable expectation that it would exist for a full 10 years, that $15 million would be allocated annually, and that the state of Minnesota was interested in solar generally. This bill will cripple the installation and the manufacturer community that has grown up from that promise because it does not provide any programmatic certainty. Instead, it pulls the rug out from the solar community. So we can only support a bill that provides such certainty. At a minimum, that would require that the Made in Minnesota program stay in place unless and until some other alternative is put into place that allows for the same amount of funding and for the same time duration. This program has brought companies to the state. Companies brought jobs. About 500 is what I estimate is currently in the program. DOC expects it to go up well above 1,000. And then those same jobs fed families. Removing the Made in Minnesota program will destroy those businesses, erase those jobs, and harm those families that have come to depend on this program. And what I would like to ask this committee is if it's worth subsidizing a gas plant up by Sherco, if it's worth subsidizing a shrimp plant, both of which I think are great ideas, I don't know why we can't protect the jobs that are associated with this industry. Fortunately, there are ways to make this program even better. As you might have seen last week, the Department of Commerce released its new numbers for this year, and we've doubled the amount of megawatts that are expected to be installed from last year. So costs can keep falling. We can install more and more megawatts per dollar of the watt, and we can continue to grow the rooftop solar economy in Minnesota without costing taxpayers or ratepayers additional costs. So as far as the PACE bill goes, we're not against consumer protections by any means. What we are concerned about, though, is that this PACE bill will turn off the PACE program for residential customers and never turn back on. We're happy to be a part of the working group that will go forward, but we would hope that this committee would add some sort of turn-on language so that if the group fails to put forward consumer protections, that at least residential PACE can continue, because it would be such a shame for a group of stakeholders to fail at getting residential PACE passed in the state. So if there's no further questions, I can yield the rest of my time to some of our fellow installers that have come here.
Thank you for your testimony. Martin Marud, and then we have Brandon Carbineau on deck. Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you. My name is Marty Marud. I own and operate True North Solar. We're a local solar installer located in Edina, Minnesota. My comments today are focused on Article 10. Of the bill before you here. I want to talk about three things, and that is price, competition, and consumer choice. Three things you often don't hear of when you talk about solar installations in Minnesota. First, we've seen a 40% decrease in the cost of solar installations since 2010. Costs go down, interest goes up, and folks, especially Minnesota, who want to be their own independent power producer are choosing to go solar. That's why you're seeing a major increase in the number of installations. The second is competition. Imagine you're picking out kitchen cabinets with your significant other, and the salesperson says to you, those hinges, they may or may not have a fee next year. Those door handles, they may or may not have a tax in 3 or 4 years. And that's what's before us right now with this bill regarding co-op fees. Our industry supports that everybody pays their fair share and all of that happens, but the uncertainty and the unknowns of what could happen in the future is really killing the opportunity of folks to choose to be an independent power producer. Third, I want to focus on consumer choice. In Minnesota, we have a right to install solar in your backyard or on your roof if you would like to do so. You have that right.
Excuse me, Mr. Marud. Sure. I appreciate your testimony on this point, but this section you're speaking about isn't currently in our omnibus bill. This isn't a different bill? The co-op language?
Article 10 of the co-op bill.
Let me double check here with staff.
Sure.
Just want to make sure we're on track.
Yeah, no problem.
Nope, it's not. If you'd please keep your testimony to the contents of the bill, that'd be great.
Sure.
If you do have concerns, though, about another bill, we'd be happy to hear them. Just contact staff. We'd love to talk to you. But we need to keep within the content of the bill itself.
Understood. I'll yield my time to another.
Thank you. Brandon Charbonneau, and then looks like Braden Solem. Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Brandon Charbonneau. I'm with All Energy Solar. I'm here to speak to the impacts that I see for not only myself but my company with some of the language we see about repeal of the RDF and specifications for the Made in Minnesota incentive. And I won't touch on the co-op bill, but that also impacts our business as well. Right now, it's the beginning of spring. We've already planned out this year for installations. We're a small business. If I don't know what I'm doing tomorrow, we're not going to be in business. Right now, I'm planning for 2018. With this bill and this language, I don't know what I'm doing in 2018. I don't know what I should be doing the rest of the year. I am the one that's on the front side. I'm helping people get projects planned, help them understand their choices, help them understand the economics of solar. Right now, I have nothing to discuss because I'm currently waiting for legislation that will either close the door on rooftop solar or will open the door and allow us to keep working. This Made in Minnesota bill is the reason I have a job in Minnesota in solar. By taking it away, we're also looking to take away jobs. I also support a part of a team. There's 30 people that are directly part of me going out and working and procuring projects. So if my job is gone for next year because we don't know, we don't have certainty, that's 30 mouths that we're not going to feed. If we do have certainty, we'd be looking at growing as a small business in Minnesota. I could easily be employing over 150 jobs, more than what we're talking about for gas plants in Minnesota. So I just want to have people keep in mind business certainty when we're making these decisions. You know, and we do have this plan as a small business. You know, I can't even write a 3 or 5 year business plan because I can't even write a 1 year business plan. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Braden Solem, and then on deck we have Ralph Jacobson. Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record.
My name is Braden Solem. I'm Vice President of Business Development at Ideal Energies. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I want to testify here today on the Made in Minnesota repealer language of the omnibus bill here. That makes up the Made in Minnesota program, we're a commercial solar company, makes up a significant portion of our business. So I want to talk to you about that language specifically today. First off, there is an infographic that was provided that we put together that talks about actual statewide job impact of the Made in Minnesota program. You should have a copy of it. But I'm going to speak with you just about the impact on our company specifically. When the Made in Minnesota Solar Incentive Program was founded, the legislature provided a 10-year commitment by the state through this program to give the foundation for private businesses like ours to invest in the development of Minnesota's solar economy. Our business did exactly that. The state created the incentives to catalyze the necessary foundation for the solar industry in Minnesota through manufacturing, installation, financing, construction, etc. In 2010, when our company Ideal Energies was founded, there were two employees, our CEO and his business partner. Then, upon the inception of this program, they saw the opportunity to scale their small company up and fully invest in Minnesota solar. In the last 2 years, we've hired 16 more full-time employees with the expectation to double our numbers of employees this year and moving forward. Additionally, we've consistently hired 2 contracting teams to build projects full-time. We have accountants, we have structural engineers, we have lawyers, all that we keep on retainer and on staff as well. On top of that, we've invested heavily to satisfy the objectives of the Made in Minnesota program through investments in infrastructure. We have 2 offices, a warehouse. We've got warehouse equipment in our warehouse, inventory, trucks, a crane, lifts, all and more financed with personal guarantees from our CEO and then long-term bank debt. All on the promise that this program would be available for us to achieve the state's goals and for us to recover on our investment in Minnesota that this program invited companies like ours to make. The most radical aspect of House File 2209 is that it abruptly cuts our company and this industry off at the knees by eliminating the Made in Minnesota program with no responsible sunset or replacement. As far as I know, no plans for these funds whatsoever that can keep us in business. All of our investment will be thrown away when our industry is delivered on our promise to the Minnesota solar economy since this program's inception. Our only option will be to lay off employees. This is not something that we do alone, as many others in the state and in this room will have to let hundreds of employees go at the abrupt, radical end of the Made in Minnesota program. With that, Mr. Chairman and members, we understand that you have concerns with the Made in Minnesota program, and we want to work with you to correct these errors while still continuing to grow this rapidly expanding industry by letting the market work. We hope you will begin working with us so we can have a comprehensive plan for the solar industry moving forward in Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Mr. Ralph Jacobson. Mr. Jacobson. We'll move on to the next one here. Mr. Tim Gulden, and then on deck we have Cliff Kaler. Tim Gulden or Cliff Kaler? Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Cliff Kaler. I am the CEO of Novel Energy Solutions. Before I start, I want to thank you guys for having us here and having solar advocates here as well. I'm going to testify on the Made in Minnesota language. And to give a brief background on Novel Energy Solutions, we're a family-run company out of southeastern Minnesota that's been growing rapidly these last few years, in no small part due to the legislation that has come from this capital, because it allows us to compete on an even playing field with the utilities. We're not asking for any different treatment in terms of support than the utilities currently get from the regulatory environment. And when I testify on this Made in Minnesota, you know, as I talk about this, I don't want to just ask for money because it benefits solar, which benefits me. I want to ask for something that I think benefits the state as a whole, as opposed to as a handout. And solar benefits the state as a whole, the reason being, we save people money. As we save them money, we create jobs for ourselves, we save our customers money so that they create jobs. My background before starting Novel Energy Solutions was working on Wall Street as a financial analyst. And so when we sell our product, we only sell based on the financial measures. Now, there's a lot of talk that solar gets subsidies. We absolutely do. But I would trade every single subsidy we get for the exact same treatment of the utilities, and I can tell you, if I got a guaranteed profit on every dollar of cost that I spent, my business would be a lot less risky, and it'd be a lot, it'd be pretty easy to go get funds from any bank or any investor. So on Made in Minnesota, the program has problems, no doubt about it. You know, we use the program, we've used it extensively, it's good for our customers. But just because a program has problems doesn't mean you throw away the program. It means you fix the program. You know, what I think would make sense is moving the funds from the Made in Minnesota to the Solar Rewards program and increasing that. Now, the reason why I like that is you're not reducing the funding for solar, so you're not negatively impacting the jobs. In fact, I think you're actually improving it, because by moving it to Solar Rewards, you would increase the competition, as it's a flat rate for all manufacturers. You would decrease duplicative programs. Made in Minnesota and Solar Rewards, there's no reason we have two of them. We should just have one. You're going to decrease the bureaucracy for installers and customers. I can tell you that's a much more streamlined program than Made in Minnesota. And with that, you end up increasing the jobs, and so the state gets more bang for their buck. So I'm not here saying that, you know, I want money because it's good for me. I mean, obviously, I want stuff that's good for me. But solar creates jobs, it saves our customers money, and the fact of the matter is, we're 2 to 3 years away from being able to compete with all of the utilities without any subsidies. There's no risk of we're gonna have solar in Minnesota in 4 to 5 years no matter what happens. Now, the question is though, is that solar gonna be built by local Minnesota companies? Or are we gonna hurt the solar industry and in 3 to 4 years have outstate companies come in, create the solar, and we lose that whole opportunity for all those jobs and all those homegrown companies? So in conclusion, I'm supportive of solar, and I think we should move the Made in Minnesota funds to the Solar Rewards, which accomplishes both goals of improving the program while not impacting solar jobs. And the reason for that is solar creates high-paying jobs, it's a growing economy, and it saves our customers money, and it's not a Democrat or Republican issue. It's an economic and a job growth issue. And that's why I feel that we should keep the funding for solar. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. We have Warren Hansen. And then by any chance, is he here? We got him down for after two, but I figured we'd give it a try. Commissioner Mike Rothman, are you available? Okay. He's on his way. All right, we'll put that on hold. We'll move to the supplemental list here. Moving right along. Eric Tretbar, are you available? Eric Tretbar. And then we have Carrie Kloster. Carrie Kloster, are you here? How about Matt Roy? Matt Roy. Steve Carver? Looking for Steve Carver. Lucinda Winter. Lucinda Winter. Joe Sullivan. Looking for Joe Sullivan. Mr. Sullivan. Stephen Letnies. Oh, we got a... Oh, thank you. Commissioner. Commissioner, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mike Rothman, Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Commerce. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you this morning. I had the chance to just off the top of my head say I was down in Orinoco this morning listening to farmers and some folks about the difficulties in their lives and all that. But it reminds me that it's important for us to continue to try to find ways in which we do the good things. And if we see things that aren't working, we need to fix them. And I'll just be straight with you. I sent a letter to the committee, to the chair, about our concerns, our serious concerns with legislation. And I wanted to share those with you at a very high level. I do not want to get into the details because the letter was long. We had a lot of serious concerns, both on the budget side, but as well also on the policy side. So first of all, let me call out and highlight what I believe is a terrible infringement on the executive branch authority. In the bill, as you know, are small things perhaps to you, but maybe not so when you add them all up. And they include the prohibition on transfer of funds between our internal divisions, limitations on how and who we can hire, practices with respect to the limitation of the department's number of deputies. These are things which, at the bottom line, infringe on our traditional separation of powers. It infringes on the delegation of responsibility of day-to-day management to the governor and to me as the Commissioner of Commerce. And it affects the other commissioners, I believe, that are impacted by this budget. It's micromanaging, and I believe it's irresponsible to go to that extent. In fact, the point of a consolidated agency like the Department of Commerce, where we have insurance, banking, and securities, which were separate agencies in Minnesota at one point. There are separate agencies in other states. The point of it was to create efficiencies and cost savings, and that's what we do. And we're able to spend the dollars where we need them, and we do that very well. So that's an important piece of it. Next, I just want to comment on the failure to include any of the commissioner's recommendations for the Department of Commerce's budget. For example, we have support from the financial institutions, industry, bankers, community credit unions for our proposals. They create cost savings, their efficiencies, and all that. And with respect to our policy items, again, nothing's included, really, as far as I can see. And I think that it speaks a large volume in terms of whether or not we're going to be able to find a pathway to work together to a solution. I know that that's our goal, and I just wanted to make those points. Again, these are in the letter. We go point by point to explain which ones were not included and which ones we think should be included. Then I think it would be probably wise for me to frankly, my staff gave me, I'll be honest with you, I'm going to count them, 13, 14, 15 pages of talking points. You don't want to hear them.
Nope, you're right.
So I'll cut to the chase on the policy. Not only were none of the governor's proposals like...
Commissioner, that was in jest, as you know. Please submit those 15 pages to the committee. We'd be more than happy to see those. That was just a little bit of levity here, building on what you were saying. Please submit those 15 pages to us, to the committee, so that we do have those. Please continue with your testimony.
And Mr. Chair, my comment, I appreciate your comment, because mine was meant in levity as well. I think when we talk about levity, that's good for all of us and good for the public. It's important to do that. But I do want to convey the seriousness of the mismatch here in terms of what we're trying to achieve. And I think, again, I'm happy to reach out to all the members on the committee, work for a solution, find the good, and work to a good outcome. Next, I do want to talk about a few things on the policy side. The letter speaks to some, I'll boil it down to this. I believe it's critical to maintain and fight for consumer protections. There are some provisions in this bill that are anti-consumer, that are actually the opposite. In particular, let me call out what one issue is, the adjuster licensing exemption. It's my understanding the committee heard testimony on that today. I've testified to that, and I believe, again, I have strong opposition to exempting one company from the adjuster's licensing. It's meant to protect consumers and to provide a fair and balanced marketplace. The next big item I do want to say and speak to publicly is our opposition to the telecommunications policy article, which includes the VoIP. We've had a longstanding position on that for the last few years, that we believe that the bill's far-reaching deregulation of voice over an internet protocol will be detrimental to consumers. It'll open the door to cramming, to terminating service to consumers, rate problems, denial of services across rural Minnesota, and severely impact those people that rely on our telephone systems. Again, I'm just skipping through some of these. I also would throw it out there that, as you know, the governor has made it a point that he does not want to see diminished authority with respect to the executive branch, including, I believe you've got a provision here about the commissioner's, the public utilities commissioner's authority, and some other things. We also put in there we believe that some of the provisions with respect to the public utilities, again, are anti-consumer, including the elimination of their certificate of need exemptions. Finally, I do think that, let me just say this in one piece as I'm looking at my notes. The residential PACE task force is something that is an effort to try to find a solution. We're willing and committed to working on that. However, we do need the funding to be able to get the job done in order to do that. With that, I'm pretty much done. Again, refer you to the letter. I greatly appreciate everybody's taking a close look at these and being careful about what you do. And again, I'm made myself available 24/7 as we go through the process to work this out. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. I think Representative Mahoney had a question or comment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner, I've briefly gone through your letter that was passed out, and I know you made a mistake on one particular issue in there, my issue. Overall, and I should have asked this of the other commissioners, and I wish I had a doctor's appointment I had to go to, so I wasn't here for all of them. But from the tone of your comments, I'm going to ask this question, and you can say it's inappropriate or for you to answer or not. What would your recommendation to the governor be if this bill comes to his desk in this fashion, or even with two or three of the pieces in here?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, on the last point, with the two or three pieces, what are...
Well, let's
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Let's say that there's a couple provisions that are all okay. I'll take that second half off. What would your recommendation to the governor be unless this bill dramatically changes? Dramatically changes.
To the commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, my recommendation would have to be that this we don't support the bill. And I don't know how I could do anything but to suggest and recommend a veto to the governor.
Thank you.
Representative Mahoney, follow-up.
I think you said the magic words.
Thank you for your testimony, Commissioner. Next on deck, I'm going to run this list really really quickly one more time and see more people came through. We had some folks that were in the shoot. It's Chad Schwitters here. Chad Schwitters. All right. We're going to look at Ralph Jacobson. Ralph Jacobson, are you here? No, Ralph Jacobson. Tim Gulden. Tim Gulden. I'm going to go out there. Warren Hansen. Is Warren Hansen here? Eric Tretbar.
Yep.
You're up. As Eric's making his way up to the front, is Carrie Kloster here? You're on deck. You're next up. Why don't you go ahead and join with Mr. Tretbar? You'll be second to testify. After Ms. Kloster, we have Matt Roy, if you are here, or Steve Carver. Eric Tretbar, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you very much for having me. My name is Eric Tretbar, and I am a Minnesota film producer and owner of Winterlight Films, which is a Minnesota film production company. And let me thank the committee for this opportunity to talk in favor of the Minnesota Snowbait Film Production Incentive Fund. I address you today as a business owner, a working film director, and a sometime film instructor who advises students about their job prospects in Minnesota after they graduate. I've taught filmmaking at Carleton College and Minnesota College of Art and Design. And my film production company has produced five feature films here in Minnesota that have played on NBC, the Sundance Channel, at festivals around the world, and theatrically in Europe and European TV. And my company's currently preparing a new feature film set to shoot in Minneapolis in November, and also developing several new TV series that we aim to shoot in Minnesota over the next 10 years. A similar production already underway is the recent HBO production you may have heard of called Mogadishu, Minnesota, and is an example of some of the challenges and opportunities for the Minnesota motion picture industry. Mogadishu, Minnesota was just shot in Minneapolis with a $4 million budget and is now deciding whether or not to shoot the rest of its series in Minnesota. The lion's share of 10 episodes at $4 million each would be going to pay Minnesota crew professionals, local businesses who provide ancillary and production support, catering, film equipment, entertainment, etc. By attracting two or three series to Minnesota, such as Mogadishu, this HBO series, in the next few years, we would attract even more. Out-of-state series that come to Minnesota are always impressed by our professional crew. They love the landscape. They love the people, the hardworking work ethic, and the amenities of our city. A major reason that HBO came to shoot Mogadishu in Minneapolis is our Snowbait program. And the Snowbait program not only attracts feature films and TV series like this, but it's also, in the last few years, started to attract TV commercial production back from New York and Los Angeles, where a lot of TV commercial production went in the late 90s, and we kind of lost it to other states. But it's returning in quite a big way lately. In case you're not familiar with the Snowbait Incentive Program, it is a program that reimburses 20 to 25% of film production money spent in Minnesota. In the highly competitive film industry, any states without an incentive program are frequently and usually passed over in favor of the 38 states that do have incentive programs, including states like Ohio, Mississippi, Louisiana, Georgia, and a number of other states that may seem like they don't quite have the resources for such programs. In general, film production is an industry with unlimited growth potential for any state that fosters it. Think about the insatiable appetite that we've acquired in the last few years with the TV scripted TV series that we all consume like crazy. I don't know anyone who hasn't binge-watched some series or another. And the demand for this kind of high-quality film production to supply the cable and internet providers is only going to increase in the next 5 to 10 years. So if a state has 4 or 5 TV series constantly in production with pilots and episodes and making of documentaries, feature spinoffs, that could be the equivalent of a new Toyota plant every 5 to 10 years. And the jobs that film production provides often pay hundreds of dollars per day. An entry-level job can be $200 to $300 day rate, up to over $1,000 a day. So these are extremely high-skilled, high-paying jobs. Since 2013, Snowbait projects have hired over 6,200 Minnesota residents, paid $20.6 million in wages, generated $1.3 million in income tax, and $75 million in private spending. The money Snowbait projects have generated more than offsets the $20 million that has reimbursed its 198 film productions since 2013. So I think the value is undeniable. And I know we all have our eyes on the budget. I always do as a film producer. We in the Minnesota film industry know that Minnesota can be one of the states where film production increases and even explodes. We can be known around the world as a state with a motion picture industry commensurate with an innovative, productive, and prestigious corporate giants like 3M, Ecolab, Target, or it can happen somewhere else. And this breaks our heart because we know we can do it here, and we know that we do it very well here. But to attract and retain the high-dollar business of film production in Minnesota, we need to create predictability for companies like HBO, Amazon, Netflix, with a continuation of our Snowbait funding. For instance, the HBO series I mentioned, Mogadishu, Minnesota, is now deciding where they will bring the remainder of their production dollars to finish their new series. If that series is a hit and it goes into production for 2 to 3 years, it would be hard for them to decide on Minnesota if they can't count on the reimbursements that they've already budgeted in their 3 to 5 year plans. And most film productions on any kind of scale are budgeting 3 to 5 or more years out. So predictability, like in any corporate budget scheme, is really the name of the game. Snowbait is also critical to the growth of Minnesota companies like my own. I do have my selfish reasons. I want to grow my film production company, and I want to contribute and help grow the film production industry that I've been part of for over 20 years. I'll soon be pitching some projects to people like Amazon, and if they do greenlight my projects, the first question for them will be, where do you want to shoot your project? And, of course, I'll say Minnesota. It's where I live. It's what I write about. It's a state I deeply love. And their second question will then be, well, what are the production incentives? And if we cannot match the other states whose incentives are equal or better than ours, they'll say, well, you can shoot your pine trees in New Mexico and your, you know, vista shots in Louisiana your city shots in Cincinnati. But Cincinnati, as we know, is no match for the Mississippi River where we live. And so I would prefer to shoot here. I think our Minnesota film industry, in closing, holds amazing opportunity for growth. And on behalf of the many production people who are here today in support of the Snowbait, I ask you in the strongest possible terms to fund the Snowblade program at its requested $13 million level so that our high-tech, high-dollar industry can thrive and grow and compete with the other states whose incentives are quite numerous today. I know that the present, in its present state, HF 789 is proposing only $715,000 for the first year of the biennium. And unfortunately, that can sound like a lot of money for a film project, but for the likes of an HBO production, that would barely even be the snow bait for one out of 10 episodes. And so I think it would be very difficult for them to decide to come here. We were just talking before the session.
Mr. Fredmar, we're going to need you to wrap up your comments here. We're trying to get everybody in about 3 minutes.
I apologize.
Right now you're pushing 10.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It's all right.
I can wrap it up. And please thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Our next testifier, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Carrie Kloster, and I am here today to testify on House File 789, Snowbait Funding. I am the Director of Operations at Committee Films, which is a television and commercial production company based in Eden Prairie. Our company produces national television series and documentaries for ABC, the History Channel, the Travel Channel, and several others. Over the last 3 years, Snowbait has helped to bring us over $20 million of television production work to the state. This has led to approximately 30 permanent full-time jobs and hundreds of short-term project-based jobs. These are all programs that were commissioned by television networks based out of state, which we were able to produce in Minnesota solely because of the Snowbait program. Were it not for these additional funds, we would not have been able to bring this work to the state, nor would Minnesota have been such an attractive place for large networks like ABC to grant television contracts. Our company has several projects in development right now that could conceivably double the amount of work we brought to the state over the last 3 years, upping business to $40 million over the next 3 years if the program continues. If drastically reduced, there is no doubt that we will have to move many of our productions out of state. And we'll start losing talented people who have to move to the coast to find work. And I'm not sure that our industry will be able to recover. On a personal note, I would mention that I myself am a Minnesota resident, born here. I graduated from St. Cloud State University. I myself fled to Los Angeles early on in my career to seek work. And I was able to come back here a number of years ago, and I'm continually impressed with the quality of production work that's happening in the Twin Cities, and I'm excited to see young people flourishing in this industry here today. So I sincerely hope that something can be done to save Snowbait and keep these jobs and the production money flowing into our state. Thank you for allowing my testimony today.
Thank you. Thank you for your time. Sir, were you next? No. We're looking for Matt Roy. All right, Matt Roy, we got Steve Carver on deck. You're Steve, all right. After Steve, we've got Lucinda Winter. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you. I'm Matt Roy. Thank you very much. I am here on behalf today of the Snowbait program and our company, Headwaters Entertainment. We are a small Iron Range-based production company aiming to promote workforce through the business and art of filmmaking, and the production of compelling and commercial films that support economic development and growth and sustainability in the Iron Range. We hope to grow and provide more and more employment opportunities and showcase the region. Cutting Snowbait will drastically limit our ability to work with out-of-state entities on several various projects in the works. The rebate is not a form of return or profit for us, but a way for us to directly reinvest into the community, the state, and help us to continue to build upon human and eventually the physical infrastructure on the Iron Range. Snowbait and other similar rebate programs allows us the opportunity to offer Minnesota filmmakers, artists, and musicians a platform to bring their visions to life and employ many rural Minnesotans in the process. Mm-hmm. This is an industry that can be sustainable, but without Snowbait, we will limit ourselves to the amount of productions and employment opportunities that other states are offering. Mm-hmm. and once again becoming a state of exported talent and potential of millions of dollars of statewide spending. Thank you. Any questions?
Oh, thank you for your testimony. Does that conclude your testimony?
Yes, it does.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Steve Carver. On deck, we have Lucinda Winter, if you are here. If not, Joe Sullivan, if you are here. Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record.
Steve Carver, and thanks for having me. I'm a producer. I go back and forth a bit between here and Burbank. Born and raised here. I bleed purple. I pee yellow and gold. Yellow and green, Packer colors.
Too much information.
I don't want to repeat what a lot of people before me have said, but I wholeheartedly back what they do say. Matt, who I actually haven't met, is somebody that I want to work with. But if there's cutting cuts to this program, Snowbait, there's no chance I will ever work with him. I will not bring any work up to the Iron Range, where we, believe it or not, have discussed at length shooting a desert movie up on the Iron Range. I expect to see a couple people look up. It's possible because it's Hollywood, and Hollywood once turned a parking lot into a desert in the middle of Burbank. We can turn an open pit mine into a desert. My discussions with them up on the range, IRRB and others, have been extensive over a period of time, but the only reason to shoot in Minnesota for a businessman, and movies, while they are art, they are more business than art. It's a unique industry that matches both of them, where if I produce biomass, that's business. We're creating money, and it either works or it doesn't. Art is different. Art is totally subjective. At least half of it is. Half of the movie industry is about making money. And when I go to an investor and say, I have a great movie, and it was referred to earlier, what are the first questions that come about on that? They'll say, well, what is it? But they don't really care what it's about. What they care about is, does it make money? And part of that, as an investor, is acquiring money through various ways. One of those is foreign markets. Foreign markets will give you money based on your cast. So they'll say, who's in your movie? I'll say, Tom Cruise. And they'll say, what's your budget? $100 million. All right, we'll give you $40 million to shoot that, as long as you play your movie overseas, which, by the way, overseas market now encompasses 60% of all ticket sales. If you have lesser-known actors, they won't give you any money. One of the other ways to get a movie financed is through rebates, and it's a huge part of it, and it ranges anywhere from 10% to almost 40%. So as an investor, and I want to make a movie, I say, okay, can I get some foreign distribution money, and can I get some rebate money? And that's going to determine where I shoot. That's why we can shoot a desert movie in northern Minnesota, because the money will make sense, if it makes sense. If it doesn't, well, actually, we'll go to Louisiana or Oklahoma. And I don't want to do that because I bleed purple. And for my partners, right or wrong, it is about the money. For me, I'm a Minnesotan. I want to bring more industry to Minnesota. We're the land of 10,000 lakes, but really, we could be the land of 10,000 arts because we're second in the nation per capita in theater seats. We have more liberal arts colleges than 44 other states in the United States. This is what we do. And unfortunately, we're chasing a lot of those people out of state, to California, to New York. I could build a whole movie of 350 people from people that I know in California that are from Minnesota because they can't get the work here because we don't support the film industry. I'm asking for the opportunity to shoot here. The four movies that I have slated to shoot, including that Western, the series, the TV series that I'm leaving here to go talk in a production meeting about over in Northeast that will shoot here and showcase Minneapolis, St. Paul, northern Minnesota. We can bring a lot of awareness to our area. We can bring a lot of jobs to our area. But cutting to this program won't do that. There are other vehicles, but this is a great vehicle to showcase what we have as a state. And that's really what I want to do because I'm proud of my state. And I want to spend more time here. And by more time, I mean April to late October. I don't necessarily want to be here November to January. And you know why? Skiing. I like water skiing. How about that? This can happen, and I think we need to put more towards this. And I'll tell you, $13 million is great, but this industry could explode here with even more than that. And I'm not here asking for money. That's not my deal. But I want you to be aware of the opportunities that are out there. And I don't want to be outperformed by Louisiana anymore, because we're better than that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next up here, do we have Lucinda Winter or Joe Sullivan? Welcome to the committee. Please state your name.
Good afternoon, members of the committee and Vice Chair. My name is Lucinda Winter. I work at Minnesota Film and Television, and I'm the Executive Director at Minnesota Film and TV, our state film commission. We've been functioning as your film commission since 1983, and in that time we've seen our industry go through several large growths, and then along with the rest of the nation experienced a recession around 07, 08. And for much of that time, since 1997, there has been in statute a production incentive called Snowbait. And Snowbait is a way of, we use it as a tool to attract production to Minnesota. We are in good company with about 35, 36 other states that do the same thing. So, number one, I would like to thank the committee for, in the coming biennium and in this omnibus budget bill, supporting our office funding. We very much appreciate that. The Snowbait funding in this bill, this is also known as the Minnesota Production Jobs Program, has been drastically reduced from the amount in the current year. We had $6.5 million, and since 2013, $20 million for a Snowbait program. And I thought the other people who work in our industry, who, and I appreciate their presence here, have spoken about the impact of such a reduction would have on their businesses. I thought I'd just spend 2 minutes giving you a quick snapshot of what we've been able to do with the $20 million that we have received from the state for our Snowbait program since 2013. Since that time, we have had 198 projects certified for the program. That is feature films, TV shows and series, commercials, and documentaries, all of them produced in Minnesota. And we only reimburse the spend made in Minnesota. They come in, they hire Minnesota businesses, Minnesota workers, they stay in our hotels, they rent our cars, they rent condos. When they're not shooting, they're out enjoying Minnesota and they're spending money on movies and canoe rental and, they're going up north, they're running around like any tourist when they're not shooting. But they're spending an amazing amount of money in our state. As a result of that $20 million investment that the state of Minnesota made, because we audit their finances, we know exactly what they spend here. We do not reimburse any money until a financial review after completion of production, so we know what they're doing. We've had a spend of about $75 million private new dollars as a result of these programs. We have had $20 million of that $75 million is in Minnesota resident wages. So it's a labor-intensive industry. Total Minnesota residents hired, the people who have worked in front of and behind the camera that are Minnesota residents on these projects, 5,000 people, about 5,000 people have been hired. And the income taxes paid, of the income taxes we can track, which is actually an underestimation because some people work as independent contractors and you hire them and their equipment and their trucks, and they file their own taxes. But we have been able to track $1.3 million in Minnesota income taxes spent. Right now in our program, we have committed all but $600,000 to projects. There's always a lag between when we certify a project, they come in, they complete their business, we do the review, and they get their reimbursement check. So, but right now we have $600,000 to commit. We're sort of at a crucial juncture here, and that's why I'm here asking for reconsideration of this real drastic reduction, because after 3 years, the word is out. We've been doing a lot of marketing. We have had, as others have mentioned, Netflix here, HBO here, Fox Searchlight for the first time with Wilson, and great Minnesota companies being able to attract projects to the state and contracts with networks because we've had the funds for reimbursement. We're at a critical juncture. And this sort of a reduction in our funds would basically take us back to square one. And we'd have to start all over again were we to become adequately, you know, competitively funded again, attracting that business, making those relationships. And as Steve Carver said in his testimony, these are companies that have, they project out 3 to 5 years in their business planning. I've seen some of these. They will actually have rooms where they're projecting the 60 or 70 projects they have at HBO and how long they're going to run. And the numbers are very significant on a run that long. They can go as usually they'll spend in a season anywhere between $40 and $80 million in a state running, making 10 episodes. So we're losing all the momentum we've gained with this level of reduction in funding. And that would be a real shame for this industry. It's a growth industry. It's an industry attractive to young people. It's a way for us to help maintain young people in our state. And it's also an industry where the private spending and labor is very, very high. So I appreciate your consideration, and I really thank you for allowing me to testify.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Do we have Joe Sullivan available? Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Joe Sullivan. I'm with the Center for Energy and Environment in Minnesota and Minneapolis. Thank you for the opportunity to testify here. Sorry I wasn't here earlier when you called my name out, but there's a couple provisions I would like to speak to in the bill. First, I'd like to thank the committee for including the property assessed clean energy, the consumer protections legislation into the bill. We're very strongly supportive of this. We think it's really important that we put in place some strong consumer protections. As for the SIP provisions that are in the bill, this is Representative Baker's legislation that he carried. I testified last week that we have concerns about that. We think that the process around the SIP and improving SIP for some utilities needs to be driven through the there's a potential study that's being done in the state right now. We think that's a more surgical approach, and that will lead to better outcomes. We think fundamentally the issue with the language in the bill right now is it's rather arbitrary, and that the size of a utility is not the determiner of whether or not it may or may not be struggling meeting the goals of the conservation program. Also, on the budget request for the Public Utilities Commission and the public and the Department of Commerce, would like to understand where the committee is right now. In our view, when the bill comes back from after its conference, we support the funding request that the Senate has included in its bill. From our perspective, this is a very important year for conservation and the conservation programs. This is when all the utilities' 3-year programs are approved at the Commission and by the Department of Commerce. So those organizations, in order to process the conservation programs, really need to be at full funding, or they need to have adequate funding. So we strongly support that they have the resources so that we, CEE, other energy efficiency implementers, can get out and do the work of actually implementing efficiency throughout service territories. And lastly, on the provisions of the bill dealing with the Public Utilities Commission and reforming the commission, first of all, I'd like to make a plug. We are strongly in support of the current selection process for commissioners. We think that's led to a professional staff, that there have been extremely strong commissioners that have been appointed by governors over the last 20 years. And so we're very strongly supportive of that. It is a process that insulates commissioners from the political pressures of an election. And so we, first of all, would make a plug for just the basic structure as it is. But I would also say that the reforms that are anticipated in the legislation would be very disruptive, and they're very significant reforms. So at a minimum, I would suggest that the committee look for a longer study that to take a look at the different ways that commissions across the country are appointed, that, you know, there are commissions that are appointed through elections, by governors, and I would take a look at the pluses and minuses of each approach and the type of commission that we want, and see which approach will drive to that. So with that, I thank you for your time, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for your testimony. We'll move along here. Is Stephen Letnice available? Stephen Letnice. And on deck we have Kaiying Yang, if you're here. All right, we'll have you on deck. And then after Kaiying Yang, we have Pang Vang is up in number three. Mr. Letnice, please state your name for the record. I hope I didn't butcher it.
Stephen Letnice.
Letnice, thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please continue with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. I am a film composer. What that means is I write the music under all the lovely romance stories and comedies and action films that we enjoy. That is what I do. I'm here to talk briefly about HF 789 Snowbait. I personally would like you to reconsider the amount that you're looking at doing for Snowbait. And a big reason for that is I personally am involved in two films right now that will gobble up half of the allotted amount. One of them is being shot up in Ely right now. And the other one will be shot later this year. It's a feature called Blues Man. And it stars James Earl Jones and Malcolm McDowell. Just imagine Darth Vader himself walking through Northfield. You know, it's and my part in that is not as a composer, but as an associate producer. What that means is I'm going to hire people. And I'm going to specifically hire people who are disabled, because I am a working film composer with films through Sony Pictures, and I am blind. And what I want to do is enable other people, other marginalized people, people with sight challenges, people with mental challenges, veterans who are unemployed, to come on the set and be a part of a team, and to potentially lose the amount of money that would like to cut in Snowbait could hurt the opportunity for me personally. I'm getting very myopic, but I want to help people in the state. And if we lose Snowbait, or if we minimize Snowbait, this film might not be filmed in Minnesota. So it's very personal for me. But I know you have a tough job, but I'm Minnesota made, and I want my films to be Minnesota made too. So thank you very much, and take care.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Kaiying Yang and Pang Vang, you're up next after that. And then number three, we've got Nick DiGiulio. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Kaiying Yang, Policy Director for the Coalition of Asian American Leaders. CAL is a network of nearly 600 individual leaders representing all sectors. We also actively collaborate with organizations to bring racial communities to the public policy table. We have established a strong and diverse coalition of 40 organizations from throughout the state working in multiple disciplines to support House File 2167, which is being passed out to you. The name on the file is Nonprofit Infrastructure, Workforce Development and Partnership Program. However, on behalf of these organizations, I am disappointed that House File 2167 is not included in this House bill. First, I would like to thank all the bill authors, Representative Hamilton, Representative Moran, Representative Mahoney, Representative Baker, Representative McQuaid, Representative Flanagan, Representative Thiessen, Representative Lee, and Representative Metza for supporting us. In a nutshell, House File 2167 would appropriate funds to the Nonprofits Assistance Fund, an intermediary organization which would provide technical assistance and re-grant the funds in a competitive process to culturally specific or nonprofits from throughout the state that have a budget of less than $500,000. Nonprofit organizations play an important role in Minnesota's economy and workforce. They provide essential services, employ local residents, and improve the quality of life. In fact, in Minnesota, Minnesota is home to 7,000 registered nonprofits, with small nonprofits making up over 70% of the total. Minnesota's nonprofit sector employs 11.5% of the state's workforce. Nonprofits of all types and sizes are essential partners to local and state agencies and to the business community. The Minnesota Council of Nonprofits affirms that smaller, culturally specific organizations know their communities best. They work to address some of the state's persistent racial and ethnic gaps across issue areas. However, they have a harder time than larger mainstream organizations in assessing a diverse pool of funds or resources. This bill targets organizations led by and serve African Americans, Asian Americans, Latino Americans, and American Indian to utilize the resources to have a positive impact on lives and communities across Minnesota. This is important because the state demographer estimates that by 2035, communities of color will make up 25% of Minnesota's population. This growth is happening in the metro and greater Minnesota. The fastest growing groups are Asians, followed by Blacks and Hispanics. Most of the populations of color are much younger than white Minnesotans. Notably, Somali and Hmong have half or more of their population under the age of 21. Communities of color will make up a large segment of the Minnesota's future workforce, and it is vital that they are well prepared. Culturally appropriate nonprofits play a critical role in this preparation. They are key to building strong and vibrant communities. These nonprofit organizations minimize the burdens on government. Please include House File 2167 in your bill because it will have statewide impact and benefits. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members, for your consideration.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony, Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the testifier. Obviously, I'm signed on the bill. We've talked a number of times, but maybe you might want to share very briefly when you talk about Target's funding to support the infrastructure building of small cultural specific. What kind of infrastructure building are we talking? Is this brick and mortar? Is this intellectual property? Is this process, back office processing?
Mr. Chair. There's three ways that the program would work. One is to have partnerships with large institutions such as government agencies or other nonprofits to support the smaller organizations so that they can build, for example, their financial management, their data collection, and so on, so that it would strengthen the capacity of the organization. A third way is for the organization to work closely with, with other nonprofit organizations in order to employ more people to their organization and therefore prepare those employees to the workforce program. So it's a combination of back end, but also really to assist the larger agencies and institutions, because many of these organizations have either the language capacity or the cultural competency to be doing some outreach work and supporting existing agencies.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony.
My colleague, Ms. Pang, is not here. She was here this morning, but she could not come back. Thank you.
Did she have a written document that she'd like to have distributed?
Yes. I don't have it with me, but I will submit it.
All right, just contact the page. They should be able to help you. Thank you for your
testimony.
Thank
you very much.
Mm-hmm. Nick DiGiulio. Nick, are you here? And then... Nick DiGiulio, and next on deck we have Andrew Peterson. If you're here, Andrew, be ready to move, and then after that it'll be John Paccio or Paccio. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Nick DiGiulio, and I'm here today on behalf of the Economic Development Association of Minnesota, also known as the EDAM. Throughout the session and back to last summer, many of you have been contacted by EDAM members regarding MIF, JCF, and the redevelopment grant programs. Members have discussed how these programs help drive economic development back in your districts and how they've helped keep and retain businesses as well. As you may recall, these programs were cut during the 2016 session as part of the supplemental budget bill that was passed by the legislature. This session, EDAM made it a top priority for our members to advocate for restoration of MIF, JCF, as well as continued funding for the redevelopment grant program. We were disappointed to see in House File 2209 that there was only a small increase for MIF in the first year and that JCF was cut again and there was no new funding for the redevelopment grant fund. As noted in previous hearings this session, these programs deliver a more than 20-to-1 investment, annually generate over $1 billion in private investment, and support the creation of thousands of jobs across the state. While we're still hoping that the programs can be fully funded as requested in House File 1916 that Representative Howe introduced, we urge you to take a second look at the proposed funding limits of this bill, and we look forward to discussing these programs with you all throughout the rest of the session. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Andrew Peterson, if you're here. Representative Mahoney, did you have a question?
Yes, sir, Mr. Chair. Does EDIM have a position on the provision in this bill that limits where job creation funds can be used?
To the testifier.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, are you referring to the previous or the language regarding the flexibility of the programs or the counties that were outlined?
Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Chair, yes, the flexibility where it can be used and in the counties and cities that it won't be able to be used.
To the testifier.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, we support the flexibility that was proposed by the Governor Dayton in his bill and discussed earlier in the session. As far as the cities and counties that are outlined in the bill, we have been talking with some of our members. We do have some concerns with that. It would obviously limit certain programs, and we'd be happy to connect with members about that as well.
Follow-up, Representative Mahoney.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the members in the audience, members of the committee and the members in the audience, I guess I did a little bit of a YouTube sensation last year with my comments on how lobbyists should actually come to the table and tell us what they don't like in the bill, not just what they like in the bill. So I appreciate you coming forth and telling us that you have some concerns. That's awfully polite Minnesota-type language for that language stinks, but that's another story that we'll get into in a different avenue.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Andrew Peterson, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record, and once again, we have John Paccio on deck.
Thank you. Thank you, Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Andrew Peterson. I am the Executive Director of the Independent Filmmaker Project Minnesota, a nonprofit organization that supports the film and media arts industry here for the past 30 years. I somehow got separated from my herd, so thank you for being kind and letting and hearing one more. I appreciate it. IFP Minnesota is a nonprofit organization that represents over 500 members and literally thousands of students. We provide grants, education, equipment, and resources to media artists at every stage of their career with a special emphasis on those coming from underrepresented communities. At IFP Minnesota, those percentages are over 70% kids of color and the same percentage for those who qualify for free or reduced lunch. Like all youth media training programs and area film schools, we're turning out a diverse and talented pool of media arts professionals that need jobs to stay in the state. The jobs that Snowbait brings to Minnesota are crucial to building and sustaining careers in media arts. Media arts is a 21st century skill set that's only set to grow and become more important for every state that embraces it. And it's not just important for the professionals that work in it, but for the state and its economy. However, we are at risk of training and then losing the talent to other states precisely at a time when we could be leading and prospering. To grow the industry, it's essential that Minnesota not only generate its own work, but attract out-of-state projects to film here. This provides additional valuable experience for entry-level and established positions, raises annual salaries for existing professionals, and creates new jobs. As we've seen in all states with successful programs, entrepreneurship and innovation follow. And I speak from experience. I started off as a location manager on films, on major films. I then grew the skills to become a producer myself. I produced a film called Older Than America about the Native American boarding school experience. It shot with Bradley Cooper up on the Fond du Lac Reservation. We then shot Thin Ice with Alan Arkin and Greg Kinnear here that I produced during the height of the economic depression. We shot in Hopkins and Hastings, and we kept businesses open through that winter. We rented space on a Tim Allen movie, Joe Somebody. We paid $300,000 to one location. That person's taxes went up that year. We get a lot of bang for the buck when we do come here and we work. Thin Ice also employed, and I think we haven't mentioned this, actors. 38 speaking parts in that film, 35 went to Minnesotans. They cobbled together a career in a very meaningful way with films like this, and it creates careers. Josh Hartnett, Amy Adams, these people may not be household names today if we did not have movies in this state that discovered the theater talent that was here and happened to be here at the time that those movies shot. I wanted to highlight just recently, it's happening in every other state. Ohio, under its current governor, recently increased their incentive from $20 million to $40 million and allocated $7.5 million for the creation of a film school, the first in the state. Of course, each state must find the incentive that's right for it, but this is an indication of how important states recognize the value of media arts to their economies and the futures of the state by retaining and attracting talented professionals. I will just close by saying that the current state of the bill puts our industry on life support. and endangers hundreds of businesses like IFP. We've been around 30 years, and I may not be able to guarantee that we'd be around for another 30 years. We work with large numbers of Somali, Hmong, Native American kids making films and finding their voices, and then taking that, making films and documentaries that tell their stories, and taking that to the world and showing how diverse Minnesota truly is. I encourage you to reconsider the funding level for Snow Bay to ensure a bright and diverse economic future for Minnesota. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. John Paccio. I know I butchered that. And then Brad Leto or Leto. And then after Brad, we've got Matt, how do I pronounce this? Privitatsky. I think I got that one. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name.
Yes. Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Thank you.
My name is John Pacheco.
Pacheco. All right, well.
I'm the workforce, Latino Workforce Initiative Director for CLUES. That is Comunidades Latinas United en Servicio. It's a good thing you didn't have to name my, not only my name, but my whole title. I'm here today actually for a few things. One is to say thank you. Thank you for providing the support we received last year at the last, in 2016. And more importantly, thank you for including us in the bill today. CLUES has been around for a number of years. In fact, last year we celebrated our 35th anniversary. We are the largest Latino organization in the state of Minnesota with over 100 employees at this point and a little over $8 million budget. We are a multi-service organization. We have mental health, chemical health, senior care, employment, youth services, and a number of other programs that we provide. We provide that mostly in the metro area. The purpose of the workforce initiative was really to look at how do we develop careers and increase prosperity in the Latino community. As many of you know, Latinos have the largest gap in income right now in the state of Minnesota. In fact, make 20,000 less than the majority population on an annual basis. And we often joke within the communities, it's not like Latinos don't have jobs. Quite frankly, we have too many of them. So they have three and four jobs. And so what are we looking at now? As we're looking at, they're trying to raise families on that kind of wage. And so our goal with this was to really increase the prosperity, increase the opportunity for training to get careers, not jobs, but careers. I think in today's market, it's not that hard to get a job, but to get a career and make it sustainable is what our goal was, or and continues to be. And we do this in a number of ways. First of all, we provide what we call navigators. And so we sit down with the individuals and the families, quite frankly, and look at what are the career goals, what will get you to where you're going to be, and what are the opportunities ahead for you, and then provide that support for you once we get you into the training. And what we've done here is we've looked at careers and met with industries to say, where are you growing and what can we do to provide that type of training, and what is the secondary training that goes with that? So in the metro area right now, CLUES provides in-house customer service training. And we've actually placed quite a few folks in banks and other customer service entities after they go through our training. We also do call center training. And there are some call centers that actually would pay a dollar more if the person speaks Spanish. And so that it is a career opportunity. It's just not a phone call, if you will. And then in partnership in the metro area, we do finishing trades. We work with the unions and the trade in their training and their pre-apprenticeship program. And so we work with folks that come in, and we do what we call a bridge to your future. And that really sits you down and says, you know, where are you at with your English skills, your math skills, your ability to communicate, your resume, how do you interview? And so we really get them ready. So by the time they go to these pre-apprenticeship programs, they feel like they have a step up already. And so in the metro area, that's what we started. And as you know, part of this legislation or significant in this legislation is that 50% of all the resources go to Greater Minnesota. Now, that's kind of somewhat new for us because we're predominantly a metro organization. But we looked at it and looked at the philosophy is that this is southern Minnesota in particular is really has a long history of Latino families, third, fourth generation. Myself, I'm third generation. And so what are the careers there and how is that working? And so we really went down and we met with the folks in Wilbur and Rochester and Austin and Mankato and looked at what are the jobs, what are the careers, where are the population, and we met with the community, we met with the industries, and we met with the public sector as well as the workforce development sector. And just because I know I don't have a lot of time here, I'll just give you a brief update of where we are today. In Rochester, for the first time, we started a partnership for CNA, Certified Nursing Assistants, our first effort in healthcare. But we did that in partnership with a local nonprofit called Bridges to Healthcare, who also partners with Mayo, Olmsted County United Way, and the local Workforce Development Center. But combined, we created a cohort designed for Latinos to be involved in healthcare and look at it as a career path. Based on our success there, quite frankly, we were able to do a similar model here in the Twin Cities with Red Cross. And now we run a CNA training and partnership with them with phlebotomy as well as blood technician, where they were looking for employees. So they not only become a trainer, they're an employer. In Rochester also, we worked with the Carpenters Union and the pre-apprenticeship carpenters for carpenters. They have a major training center there. And both of them, we have now 17 in the healthcare and 16 registered or are going to be registered for the carpenters training. But again, they're on a career path, and then we support them for up to 1 year later. In the metro area, again, we've done healthcare, customer service, and call center service. We really look forward to coming back to you here next year and report on our success. We think the money has been well used, and again, our philosophy has been to partner with other folks. We are not just going somewhere, taking our model, saying, this is it. In southern Minnesota, it's been well received, and we've had the support of not only the local nonprofits, but the local economic development entities and others. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Brad Leto. And then we got Matt Privatatsky here on deck. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Brad Leto, you were right the first time. Thank you. Legislative Director for the Minnesota AFL-CIO, and taking Representative Mahoney's points to the heart, I will say some good things and some concerns that we have with the bill, both. First, the additional funding for the wage theft initiative at the Department of Labor and Industry, we definitely support and appreciate. The Helmets of the Hard Hats program with the bullying trades and the veterans, Pathways to Prosperity funding, and workforce development funding, with the exception, I've said this under Democrat administrations, Republican administrations, that we always are concerned when a number of other bills take money from the Workforce Development Fund. Especially when we get into recessions. Of course, we're not in one now, but we do are concerned about that. But do appreciate the funding for the Workforce Development Fund. We do oppose the cuts to the Bureau of Mediation Services and the elimination of the Public Employee Relations Board. It's not a huge budget, but it is important. And I kind of equate the Public Employee Relations Board to, and I know there's a number of committee members here that are familiar with project labor agreements with building trades members and communities, so that there's no work stoppage during the, if there's any dispute between unions and employers, that they continue the work and they work out the differences. The Bureau of Mediation Services of public employers and unions do, you know, their role is to work out differences. And otherwise, everybody ends up in court. And that just takes a lot longer and it's a lot more expensive. And so it is important, I think, to fund the Bureau of Mediation Services. We are concerned with the elimination of funding for some of the equity programs that were just funded last year. So we'd like to get some data on how they're working before we eliminate those. And we don't generally get involved in case management systems for agencies or anything like that. The one thing, though, is the Department of Labor and Industry's case management system, especially with the funding of wage theft, which is in labor standards, it seems to get the best bang for the buck that would be worthwhile to start funding that as well. The final thing, and I apologize that I was not here, I was in another committee to testify against the voice over internet proposal bill when it was heard separately in this committee, but we do oppose that. We have opposed that in the past, and we continue to oppose that proposal, and had a resolution at our state convention in September that passed unanimously opposed to that. Thank you. Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you for your testimony. Matt Privatatsky. And then we have Justin Fay on deck. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record, and hopefully I didn't butcher it too hard.
Mr. Chair, no one should be bothered with my last name, so that's fine. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to testify. My name is Matt Pabratsky, and I lead the legislative work for Fresh Energy, an independent nonprofit that provides in-depth research and analysis on energy issues across Minnesota. First, I'll say we understand there's a lot of back and forth between the chambers during these final months of the session to come to a final agreement. And one provision in particular we would hope that could make it into the final bill from the Senate chamber is the funding for both the Department of Commerce and the Public Utilities Commission. Minnesota utilities, energy businesses, and consumers all rely on these agencies to carry out rigorous analysis and oversight. In terms of policy, there are a handful of provisions we have concerns about that I'll speak to today. For the language starting on lines 167.25 regarding the Volkswagen settlement, we were happy to see this proposal discussed in committee because it seems as though there was a common understanding between the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency and the committee that any carve-outs or restrictions in statute may put those settlement funds at risk. We're hopeful that the bill can be changed to align with that understanding and ensure Minnesota receives the maximum amount of funds available to support the build-out of charging infrastructure and electric buses and cars that support our local utilities and improve local air quality. On the language starting at line 174.32, which would have members of the Public Utilities Commission appointed by leaders of each of the four political caucuses, as well as the governor, it would remove current commissioners before their current term is scheduled to end. The PUC plays a critical role in providing economic, technical, and judicial review of Minnesota's energy sector, and this language could make the appointment process for those commissioners more political. We would prefer the current system, which allows for lawmakers to provide input during confirmation hearings in the Senate. On the language starting at lines 176.6 and again on 189.13 involving resource planning at the Public Utilities Commission, that would now be required to be done in favor of job retention above other factors. A better balance is struck through the current process where decisions around job retention are considered during standard resource planning proceedings as part of the overall analysis, including cost effectiveness, job creation, and numerous other factors. Requiring that decisions must be made in favor of job retention over those other factors may actually put job creation and energy costs at risk by placing them at a lower priority. Similarly, the language that starts on lines 192.25 regarding rates to fall below the national average, regardless of other outcomes, we're strongly in favor of more cost-effective energy resources, but this bill reduces energy costs down to one single metric, and that's rates. In reality, the amount you pay on your energy bill has many factors, including the rate you pay per kilowatt hour, but also how many kilowatt hours you use, whether you're incentivized to use energy at certain times of the day at lower costs, and many other factors. The current holistic approach to analyzing rate increases and energy costs is currently keeping Minnesota's energy bills much lower than our neighboring states. The language starting on lines 179.1, carving out smaller cooperative and municipal utilities from our conservation improvement program, would leave more than 62,000 rural Minnesotans without the same opportunity to cut energy waste and save money. We're committed to working with both co-ops and munis to make improvements to SIP now and in the future, but by picking and choosing co-ops and munis at a certain customer size, it ignores the reality of how different utilities perform year to year. Some small utilities work with others to easily meet SIP goals. Some larger utilities go it alone and currently have a hard time. Customer size alone does not determine how a utility may perform in conserving energy. And I would note that even when utilities do not meet those goals, there is not currently a punishment. The language starting on lines 204.3 would severely undermine Minnesota's nation-leading building energy code by requiring technical review and rulemaking to be redone at the legislature. Fresh Energy works with building officials, builders, and consumers to improve the way our buildings are built because we know that a well-built home actually costs less to own. Our codes are already updated only once every 6 years now, which leaves 3 years of input from builders and building officials. Slowing down that even further would only lead to substandard, inefficient homes being built, with families on the hook to deal with costly repairs and expensive monthly bills. Thank you for your consideration of these concerns, Mr. Chair and members. We look forward to working with you as the bill moves forward.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Justin Thay. And on deck, we have Chris Kunkel. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and good afternoon, members. My name is Justin Fay. I'm here today on behalf of the Sierra Club. I appreciate the opportunity to share a few brief comments regarding House File 2209. I'm going to try not to – I know we're in hour four, so I'm going to try not to repeat too much of what you've already heard. So I'll start with just a general observation, which is the bill makes a significant number of changes to current law governing the form and function of the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission. The mission of the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission is to create and maintain a regulatory environment that ensures safe, reliable, and efficient utility services at fair and reasonable rates. That mission is in existing Minnesota state law. Over time, Minnesota's energy system and providers are becoming more, not less, complex, and that makes the mission and functions of the Public Utilities Commission more important than they've ever been in the past. And changes to current law that governs the commission and directs the commission should be done only very carefully and only with deep and thorough involvement from all impacted stakeholders. There's a few provisions in the current bill draft that we think don't meet this test. In Article 10, Sections 8 and 9, which amend the process for appointing PUC commissioners to the Public Utilities Commission. Section 21, which includes some problematic language that any doubt when it comes to the calculations of environmental cost must be resolved in the favor of the economy, job growth, and job retention. The word must has a pretty significant impact on what happens at the Public Utilities Commission. To be honest, I can't tell you, as an organization that does a fair amount of work there, work at the commission, exactly what the impact of this language would be, and that's a pretty scary place to be. And then finally, Section 23, which adds four new categories of exemptions to the existing Certificate of Need statute. All of these, from our perspective, are problematic and make it harder for the commission to discharge its mission of protecting Minnesota ratepayers and consumers. A related observation is simply the budget requests for the Department of Commerce and the Public Utilities Commission. We think, given the increasing challenges faced by both of these agencies and also the implications for the public as a whole, that the access to good, accurate information from the Department of Commerce, as well as timely and efficient decision-making at the commission, are more important than they've ever been. And we respectfully request that the committee consider fully funding the agency budget requests for those two agencies. I want to touch very briefly in closing on two additional provisions. The first, which Mr. Previous testifier discussed at some length, is the provision relating to legislative approval of funds for the Volkswagen settlement account. I won't reiterate his testimony except to say, as a national organization, we're tracking this issue as it's being resolved in states all over the country. And I would simply suggest caution before proceeding down this road, as this is essentially $47 million of money just sitting there that we want to have come to Minnesota and be put to good use. And the last provision that I haven't heard discussed in testimony yet today is the provision prohibiting local municipalities from adopting prohibitions on the use of disposable plastic bags. It's actually traveling in several different omnibus bills this session, but it is included in this one as well. It's Article 8, Section 10, page 151 of the Delete Everything Amendment. A number of different communities around the state of Minnesota have considered different proposals for dealing with the problem of plastic impact that plastic pollution has in our environment, and frankly, for good reason. A recent study that just came out earlier this year from the Rochester Institute of Technology found that more than 22 million pounds of plastic find their way into the Great Lakes every year, much of it from disposable bags, exactly like the ones being addressed by that provision. So we'd encourage the committee to continue to allow local governments flexibility to deal with those kinds of environmental problems in their communities. With that, I'll wrap up. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Barr, you had a quick question?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Thank you. To the testifier, you said you favor the removing the certificate of need for wind energy from the PUC?
No, Mr. Testifier. Chairman, Representative Barr, we don't support any changes to the certificate of need statute at this time.
Thank you.
Representative Barr, follow-up? No. Thank you for your testimony. Chris Kunkel, and then on deck we have Annie Levinson-Falk. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Chris Kunkel. I'm with Wind on the Wires. I'm not going to reiterate my testimony from last Monday on House File 2052. I just want to thank the committee for including the language from that bill in the omnibus. This is language that we worked on with Representative Schumacher and helps to streamline the permitting process for large wind and solar facilities in the state of Minnesota. Again, we anticipate there will be tremendous growth in renewable energy in the next couple of years, and it's a question of where that development takes place, if it's going to be in other states or if we're going to do that here. And I think that that this language is, while it's not going to solve every issue we have, it's incremental progress that we think will be a good thing. And I'll also mention, consistent with this desire to have our permits processed quickly through the various agencies, we support the agency's request for additional funding. We think that that will, by providing adequate funding for them, it will ensure more efficient work from our perspective to, again, ensure that our permits are processed as quickly as possible. And so I'll wrap it up there and happy to answer any questions that the committee might have.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Moving on, we'll move to Annie Levinson-Falk. And then on deck, we have Lisa Beth Barajas, I believe that is, if you're here. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Annie Levinson-Falk. I'm the Executive Director of the Citizens Utility Board of Minnesota, or CUB, which advocates for Minnesota's residential and small business utility customers. I appreciate the opportunity to speak, and I appreciate that you've taken a considerable amount of time while you're under deadline to hear public testimony, so I'll try not to repeat anything I've said before this committee or that other testifiers have touched on. CUB thanks you for the provisions to ensure consumer protections in the residential PACE lending program. We believe the necessary protections will be identified by the stakeholder process laid out in the bill, and we look forward to supporting a strong residential PACE program in Minnesota in the future. Again, in the interest of time, I'll focus on just two elements of the bill that were not previously heard in this committee and that CUB believes could be improved. First is the language prioritizing economic development and jobs and utility rate making and planning processes. And then second, the goal to keep Minnesota's electric rates below the national average. First, in lines 193.3 and 193.4, would make it the goal of the state of Minnesota to have commercial electricity rates that are at least 10% below the national average and rates that are at least 5% below the national average for all other classes. A main part of our mission is to advocate for affordable electric rates, and we certainly agree that electricity must be affordable and competitively priced for our businesses. I believe that costs are already weighted heavily in utility rate making, but putting it into statute could be a good idea. However, I'm not sure what practical options there are to achieve the specific targets in this bill beyond what's already done. According to the U.S. Energy Information Administration, Minnesota's average retail price of electricity in 2016 was already 2.5% below the national average and nearly 5% below the national average for the commercial class. So as far as what options there are for the Public Utilities Commission and for utilities to bring these the prices down further, I worry that we might see utilities putting off necessary infrastructure investments or not investing in innovation in order to keep prices down in the short term that would actually hurt us and increase prices over the long run. Additionally, I think the language is a little bit ambiguous as it's not defined what's included in the calculation of rates. For most customers, what's important is their total cost of electricity, not the per kilowatt hour price. So if I can power everything I need in my home for $30 a month, I'll be happy. Whether it's $30 that comes from paying 3 cents a kilowatt hour for 1,000 kilowatt hours, or 15 cents a kilowatt hour for 200 kilowatt hours. For me, it's $30 and I get everything that I need. And there can be some advantages, I think, in increasing the per kilowatt hour price as long as customers are able to keep their bills as low or lower through energy efficiency and conservation and other options. In addition, simply looking at the variable per kilowatt hour price, it will give an inaccurate comparison because utilities vary in the portion of the cost that they recover by fixed charges versus variable charges. If the utilities interpret the intent here as only to compare the variable per kilowatt hour price on the bill, they may be encouraged to put more costs onto customers through fixed charges, which could have the effect of actually increasing costs for customers. I believe that the intent here is to keep customers' total costs down, and so I would just suggest you might want to clarify that language. Second, I'd like to comment on Article 10, Sections 10 through 12, and Sections 20 through 21. Which would include economic development and job impacts as issues that must be considered by the PUC in utility rate making and utility planning. Again, CUB, of course, supports economic development. However, without changes, I believe the effect of the language as is currently written would be longer and more expensive regulatory processes that do not add value for the Commission and outcomes that would harm the majority of ratepayers. The language asks for analysis of the effects of utility rates and resource plans on economic development and jobs. This kind of cause and effect is difficult, if not impossible, to demonstrate, as we've learned through the process of Minnesota Power's proposal for a rate discount for 11 of its energy-intensive trade-exposed customers. After analysis from the utility, the Department of Commerce, the Office of the Attorney General, and other stakeholders, the Public Utilities Commission granted the proposed discount, concluding it's impossible to say with any certainty if it would have an effect on jobs in the economy, and if so, how large an effect, but that lower costs are generally good for business. Even testifiers from the industries that stand to benefit made statements that are no stronger than this one from Lawrence Sutherland of U.S. Steel Corporation, quote, "It is reasonably likely that this discount could be one of the factors that helps to keep their plant competitive." Despite hundreds of hours of time by expensive analysts, this kind of analysis leaves plenty of room for doubt. If, as this bill stipulates, quote, "any doubt must be resolved in favor of supporting the economy, job growth, and job retention," I'm afraid that the PUC would feel compelled to always decide in favor of lower electric bills for business. Lower costs, of course, are always good for business, but lower costs are also always good for families, and lowering business costs in this way will increase the share of costs paid by the residential class. If the state is going to elevate economic development and jobs among the many considerations of rate making, we should elevate affordability for residential customers along with it. Furthermore, I believe the bill may harm small businesses. Small businesses by nature have fewer resources than larger businesses and aren't nearly as well represented in utility regulatory proceedings. They generally pay under different rate structures and have more in common with residential customers than large industry. Though I believe the intent of the bill is to support businesses of all sizes, I think the likely effect will be to harm small businesses. Finally, the language talks about prioritizing job retention and job preservation through utility regulation. Rather than considering the net effects of utility decisions on jobs in total, this language would direct the PUC to preserve the status quo in the energy system, even in cases when that's not the most cost-effective for a utility's customers and when it could raise rates and cause job losses on the whole. I would respectfully suggest that net jobs would be a more appropriate consideration here. Mr. Chair and members, thank you for your consideration of CUB's view on this matter. I'd be happy to work with you if I can be any of help on these bills in the future.
Thank you for your testimony. We do have one question. Representative Wagenius.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. At the beginning of your testimony, you gave a couple of figures, and one of them I thought was we're already 2.5% below the national average. Could you just repeat that so I wasn't sure testifier. I got it right?
Mr. Chair and Representative Wagenius, that's right. I believe the average across all classes of customer, the average retail cost of electricity in Minnesota is about 2.5%, maybe 2.47 or something like that, below the national average. For the commercial class, it's about 5% below the national average.
That was the, 5% below for commercial.
Yep, and that information comes from the U.S. EIA.
Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Lisa Beth Barajas. I hope I'm hope I got that right. And then on deck, we have, we're going to go back, see if we can find, is Chad Schwitters here? Chad, are you here? All right, you're on deck. Thank you for coming. Please say your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Lisa Beth Barajas. I'm with the Metropolitan Council.
Oh, how do you pronounce that?
Barajas.
Oh, thank you. Okay. Don't ask me to do that.
We'd like to register our concern regarding Article 11, Sections 7, 8, and 9 regarding legislative approval over Metropolitan Council housing plans and Metropolitan Council's negotiated affordable and life cycle housing goals, as well as the legislative approval that's required for the affordable and life cycle housing opportunities amount, or AHOA amount, that's already described in statute. First, the council has serious concerns with all of these legislative approval requirements, but regarding the housing plan element, the council adopted its regional plan and its housing plan in 2014 and in 2015, and has since notified local governments to update their local comprehensive plans. Many local governments are well on their way, with several of them, at least a dozen of them, planning to submit their plans to the council this year for authorization. The council would not be able to act upon those plans and authorize them to be placed into effect as directed by statute should this bill go forward, because we would not be able to review those plans against our housing plan. We have some serious concerns because that this bill would significantly impact that planning work of local governments and add a great deal of uncertainty to their local processes as well. The second two provisions regard our Livable Communities program. It's a separate program, entirely a grant program. This bill would directly impact municipalities that seek to participate in those voluntary grant programs and delay their ability to be eligible for grant funds for at least one grant cycle, which is at least 1 year, if not more. The bill would also interfere with negotiations with local governments and give the legislature the ability to override the goals that are negotiated and agreed upon between the council and those local governments, and subsequently are adopted by resolution by local governments. It is unclear what this would achieve other than undermine that local undermine that negotiation process. And the last cycle of Livable Communities Act re-enrollment, which is in 2010 and will happen again in 2020, those negotiations were done in a larger group and through a large process that involved all of the affected communities who were intending to enroll in the program, as well as metro cities and a variety of housing stakeholders from around the region. Finally, it is unclear what the bill is seeking to resolve with the proposal in Sections 9 regarding the AHOA determination. The methodology for determining that local expenditure is already defined in statute, is very clear. It's a formula that the council simply implements, and it requires that communities that participate in Livable Communities, which is a voluntary program again, expend a certain amount through that formula in their community to support affordable and life cycle housing within their community. The AHOA amount is not a grant from the LCA, but rather, like I said before, is a required local contribution of local dollars. It is unclear what the legislature would do, whether they would increase it or decrease it or get rid of it altogether, because there are no parameters set forth in the bill. And again, that formula is already defined in statute. With that, I'm available for any other questions you might have. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. We have Chad Schwitters. And then on deck, we have, is Ralph Jacobson here? Mr. Jacobson or Tim Golden? Tim Golden, are you here? All right. Then on deck, we're going to put, looks like Mark Culver. You're on deck if you're here. Mark? And then just a quick note, members of the public, if you need to have a conversation, please take it out into the hallway. We're trying to make sure we get our testimony as uninterrupted. Thank you for your cooperation. Mr. Schwitters.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Chad Schwitters. I am a resident of North Minneapolis and grew up out in Chippewa County, just south of town there, a couple of miles. And I'm here to testify a little bit about Bill number 2209. I want to thank the committee for maintaining some of the base funding for housing across the state. I think there's some rhyming challenges that Greater Minnesota is having in workforce home ownership as we are in the city of Minneapolis and St. Paul. The Challenge Fund has been one of the most flexible tools that we've had in our toolbox to address some of these housing challenges. And so I just want to encourage the committee to not eliminate the Challenge Fund in the second year of the biennium. That fund has produced 576 units of housing in 2016, 51% of which were in Greater Minnesota. In 2015, 618 units were produced, 64 of which were in Greater Minnesota. And so I want to just encourage the maintenance of this flexible fund that we can continue to use to do this. Secondly, I would like to just mention quickly the bill that's known as Haven Bill. It's Bill 2112, and it's included in number 2209, which would reduce home ownership dollars in Greater Minnesota and bring more dollars into the metro. It reduces the affordability timelines on these home ownership units or on these rental units. And so I think there could be some win-win with the proponents of the Haven Bill if we could get together and continue to negotiate. So I want to thank you for hearing my testimony. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Mark Culver, are you here? Mark, and then we've got Shelley Hansen on deck. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members. I am Mark Culver. I also have Shelley Hansen here at the table with me, as well as Steve Albright. We'll be all talking about the small cell wireless bill. I am before you today as the president of the City Engineers Association of Minnesota. Our organization, which is comprised of over 400 public and private sector members, represents engineering interests for all Minnesota cities. Our members are engineers, city engineers, public works directors of Minnesota cities. Many of our members are private consultants that represent smaller cities that do not have staff engineers. In speaking with the members of the City Engineer Association, I have heard unilateral opposition to the small cell wireless bill that is included in the omnibus bill before you. We do recognize that you have been presented with some information, potentially some updates of the bill. The comments that I will be making will address the bill as is in the as was published on Friday. And there weren't, in reviewing that list, my comments still pertain even with that the list that the industry provided you this morning. All of the cities out there certainly recognize the importance of allowing new technologies in our cities that allow our businesses to be competitive and our residents to have the best possible access to the mobile internet. But we also recognize the importance of maintaining local control over the placement of any utility within our right-of-way, but particularly maintaining control over our assets, such as light poles, sign poles, and signal poles within the right-of-way. We do feel that we were making progress in discussions with the wireless industry. We would welcome the opportunity to return to the table with them. I certainly thank the industry for making the changes that they have made. Many of them are listed on that handout you had this morning. And I think it is a sign of the progress that we were making. However, we still have some specific concerns regarding the current bill. And those remain as follows. First of all, placing a cap on the allowable recoverable fees to manage the right-of-way through our permitting process. Co-location requests will require specialized review of the technical elements of the permits, such as structural requirements and capacities, and these costs could easily exceed the proposed cap of $100 each for up to five small cell facilities. We would propose that the cap be removed and the unit of government be allowed to recoup its actual costs. Currently, this bill prohibits the unit of government from passing along costs from a third-party contractor of the local government unit for the performance of any of the management activities. There are a significant number of cities and townships in Minnesota that use consultants for engineering purposes. One of the tasks that these consulting firms often perform is the review of some aspect of right-of-way permits. This language could limit a city's ability to recoup those costs for the review of a permit from a telecommunications right-of-way user. We would recommend striking this language as well. Finally, we continue to have concerns about the broad language in this bill limiting any zoning requirements being applied to this technology. We feel the language in the bill could be interpreted to limit our abilities to set limits and requirements within the actual permits as well. Overall, we fear we will lose control of how this technology rolls out, how it looks, and how it impacts our neighborhoods beyond the health, safety, and welfare. In closing, we remain opposed to this bill in its current form, but we recognize that some more negotiation is necessary to get the bill to a final, mutually acceptable state. We still feel we can get there with some more effort from both sides, and we hope this commission will allow us that time. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Welcome to the committee. Did you have further testimony to add?
Yes, Chairman.
Please state your name for the record.
I'm Shelley Hansen. I'm the city engineer in Bloomington, and I'm also representing the City Engineers Association. I have been their Complete Streets Committee Chairman for several years. And as Mark said, small cell throughout Minnesota is very important to our communities, to serve our businesses, schools, residents, to keep them globally competitive. But the one-size-fits-all approach that is in the bill does not work for all of the cities in Minnesota. The amendment that is before you, we have not had time to go through, and we had not seen before. It has not been negotiated 100% with the cities since the industry had left the negotiating table 2 weeks ago, and we would welcome an opportunity to visit with them again. One of the core functions of the cities is to manage the right-of-way for safety and efficient use of all the public and private utilities within it. Our city property owners have invested millions of dollars in the public assets that go in them, whether it's our streetlights, our traffic signals, utility poles, our signs. The bill is very broad about the definition of wireless support structure, and we're very concerned about this because the definition as it's in talks about signs, which anywhere from a street sign to a parking sign to a kiosk, which might be your sign that says Bloomington, Minnesota, or Newmarket, or you know something like that. The signs and kiosks were not originally built for this purpose. And also in our traffic signals, signalized intersections, there it's the live running system. When they put a small cell installation on it or adjacent to it, a lot of times they're hooking into our system, our electric system. We're concerned about that and about the ground-mounted equipment, clear sight distances. And in short, we do not think it's a good idea that traffic signals should be used for this purpose. They are for the safety of the traveling public. And the bill also states that management costs or right-of-way management costs by a third party cannot be included as in co-location. And as Mr. Culver mentioned, many of our cities, their city engineers and their engineering staff are by a consulting engineering firm throughout the state of Minnesota. We are very concerned about the limiting effects of the zoning authority. And we feel that if we had more time, we could work these out with the providers. This bill removes the right for cities to recover the full cost of the permit fees, and we need to continue to work on that also. The bill allows 35 separate locations in the right-of-way on one application permit. Each location, we feel, needs its own permit. These locations may be miles or blocks apart. There is no economy in scale in the review process for the cities in these permits. We need to do individual reviews on each permit, and they each need to have their permitted use. There's other utilities that are below the ground at each location, you know, above ground, on wires above. So they're very individualized on the review. We need to be able to do each one for the safety of all the users in the right-of-way. In conclusion, the cities of Minnesota want small cell in our communities. It's in our best interest. But the one-size-fits-all approach in the bill does not work for us right at this time. Right-of-way management is complicated. Sites need individual review. Cities need to cover the staff costs for those reviews and have the appropriate zoning authority to do so. The cities of Minnesota, along with the LMC, have been working in good faith and respectfully request additional time to work with the cellular providers to come to an agreement on multiple items in the bill to better safely serve the taxpayers of Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Welcome to the committee. Did you have additional testimony?
Yes, Mr. Chair. My name is Steve Albrecht of the City of Burnsville. I'm the Public Works Director. I'll make a few additional comments. I'm representing both League of Minnesota Cities and APWA, which is the Public Works Association for Minnesota. In addition to what my colleagues have mentioned earlier, you heard that it's a zoning versus right-of-way issue. It really isn't for many of the cities. Most cities already permit this type of use in our right-of-way ordinance. What this is asking is for essentially a separate right-of-way ordinance for the small cell wireless, one that's much less restrictive and dictates to the cities where these facilities can be placed, rather than having the cities review our right-of-way comprehensively and looking at what other existing uses are there, and then evaluating the public health, safety, welfare, and investment of those right-of-ways. And I want to hit on that real quickly. While the legislation does acknowledge that, what it does is it defines that health, safety, and welfare to building codes and other codes that honestly aren't part of what we do for right-of-way management. Right-of-way is primarily for transporting the public safely, both pedestrian traffic, bicycle traffic, and the public traffic. The standards that we utilize for right-of-way management are not allowed under the legislation as written to be part of the management. And so that is a concern that we have. They do include language that says government units, public right-of-way management policies, but then later they define that as building codes and other codes that aren't applicable to our right-of-way management. So we would like to have that definition properly defined. The last piece of that is the investment piece. Property owners have invested significant money in both the residential properties and the right-of-way. For the cities to have no say about what type of facility is replaced in front of a homeowner's property where there once was a light pole and now there could be a communications tower, that's simply not appropriate in our mind, and we want to be able to work with our small cell providers to make sure that if they are going to co-locate, that we find an area that's not going to impact our residents substantially. And the last piece is our other public partners that use our right-of-way. Cities currently work with the telecommunication industry. All of our local phone companies are in our public right-of-way and pull right-of-way permits and work with us on location of their facilities, along with our electric companies, gas companies, and cable companies. We don't see that small cells should have its own separate right-of-way ordinance, but rather should be subject to the same ordinance as they are and that we work together on. We recognize the importance of their services, and we want to be good partners with them, and we ask them to come back to the table and work on that with us. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Up next, we have Rick Evans. Are you available? Rick here? And then we have Warren Hansen on deck, if you're here, Warren. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Rick Evans with Xcel Energy. One quick comment, which I didn't intend to make here, but one of the earlier testifiers made a comment I wanted to respond to as to the so-called guaranteed profit of the utility companies. I won't go into our bookkeeping here as I sit here, but if anybody would like to sit down with me, I think in about 15 minutes, I can show you that Xcel Energy has nothing like a guaranteed profit. In fact, in my 15 years working for Xcel, I believe last year was the only time we even came close to earning our authorized rate of return. Every other year we've fallen short. So if there's a guarantee out there somewhere, somebody owes us a lot of money. What I really wanted to talk about, though, was the biomass, the Laurentian biomass, the section of the bill, I believe it's Section 42, that allows Xcel Energy to renegotiate power purchase agreements with the providers of our three projects that supply our biomass energy. First of all, I just want to remind the committee, this is by far the most expensive energy we buy. On average, these plants cost anywhere from 6 to 8 times as much as wind energy that we can purchase, and as much as 4 to 5 times as much of solar energy that we can purchase. This is very expensive energy. The bill permits us to have negotiations with the owners of those projects, and only when all of the parties to the contract agree can we renegotiate the contracts. And only when the Public Utilities Commission is satisfied that in that renegotiation we have saved our customers money in the process. That's what the bill permits us to do. We are concerned that our ability to do that would be limited in any additional amendments to the bill as was proposed. The last thing I'll note is that we do not serve the territory of Benson, Minnesota. It's a municipal utility. I'm not sure where they get their wholesale power, but if this is such a good deal, I would welcome them to enter into the negotiations and purchase some of this biomass power, too. That'll end my testimony. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Warren Hansen. All right. Is there anyone else from the public here that would like to testify in favor or voice concerns with the bill? With that, we will close the public testimony period and we'll open up the member questions. Members, are there any member questions at this time for any of the testifiers? Any member questions for any of the testifiers? All right, seeing none, that will conclude. It looks like we're going to conclude our business for today. GOP members, we will be having a huddle at 4 p.m. in 454 at the state office building. And with that, members, we are adjourned.